From the Southeast Asian capital city of the Philippines, 7,107 islands, Manila, I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. I greet you for the weekend, my honor, privilege, and whatever, to take you on through the weekend with fascinating stuff. I'm going to begin tonight with what is the top story, and then I'm going to follow up on it a little bit, or a lot. The top story this hour, wait a minute, just before I get into that, let me say that the webcam photo this week on Coast to Coast, I always get to put one or maybe two webcam photos up, and this was taken through my window, through my office window, just about sunset here, and looks out on Makati Metro Manila at sunset. Kind of pretty, I thought, actually taken through the window, not with the window open, mind you, but right through the window. So you might want to take a look at that, coasttocoastam.com. In addition, as you know, I spent about 10 years on the island of Okinawa, and I would very much like to get an email from somebody presently on Okinawa, preferably in Naha, Okinawa. So if anybody's on Okinawa right now and listening, please email me. I am artbell at AOL.com. That's artbell, A-R-T-B-E-L-L at AOL.com, or artbell@mindspring.com. That's A-R-T-B-E-L-L. Probably best to send it to Mindspring, M-I-N-D-S-P-R-I-N-G. artbell@mindspring.com. Now, the top story. An American thought to be an Al-Qaeda activist appeared in a videotape with the terror group's deputy leader on Saturday. That's our big story, and called on his countrymen to convert to Islam and for U.S. soldiers to switch sides in the Iraq and Afghan wars. The 48-minute video posted on an Islamic militant website had footage of Al-Qaeda's number two leader and of Adam Gadon, a 28-year-old American who the FBI believes attended Al-Qaeda training camps in Pakistan and served as an Al-Qaeda translator. So basically, what he said, you can see for yourself. I saw it on Fox News just minutes prior to the broadcast. He said, convert to Islam or die. Which, of course, is what is being repeated again and again and again. Convert to Islam or die. In a moment, I'll have a few reflections on that statement and what all this war really means. As many of you know, longtime listeners, prior to the Iraq war, I was adamantly opposed to our getting in. However, once we got in, if you'll recall, my comments were that we damn well better win it, whether I was opposed to it or not. Once we're in, we better win. The following are words of Dr. Vernon Chong, Major General, United States Air Force, retired. He made these comments back in July of 2005. To get out of a difficulty, one usually must go through it. Our country is now facing the most serious threat to its existence as we know it that we've faced in your lifetime and mine. That includes World War II. The deadly seriousness is greatly compounded by the fact that there are very few of us who can think we can possibly lose this war, and even fewer who realize what losing really means. Let's look at a few basic facts. When did the threat to the United States begin? Many would say in response to that, September 11th, 2001. The answer, as far as the U.S. is concerned, is 1979, 22 years prior to September 11. Think about it. The Iran embassy hostages, 1979, Beirut, Lebanon embassy, 1983, Beirut, Lebanon marine barracks attack, 1983, Lockerbie, Scotland, Pan Am flight to New York, 1988. First New York Trade Center attack, the first unsuccessful one, 1993. Saudi Arabia, Khobar Towers Military Complex, 1996. Kenya, U.S. Embassy, 1998. Tanzania, U.S. Embassy, 1998. Aden, Yemen, USS Cole, 2000. Remember that? New York World Trade Centers, 2001. Pentagon, 2001. Note that during the period from 1981 to 2001, there were 7,581 terrorist attacks worldwide. Why were we attacked? Envy of our position, our success, our freedoms. The attacks happened during the administrations of President Carter, Reagan, Bush 1, Clinton, and Bush 2. We cannot fault either the Republicans or the Democrats, as there were no provocations by any of the presidents or their immediate predecessors, Presidents Ford or Carter. Who were the attackers? In each case, the attacks on the U.S. were carried out by Muslims. What is the Muslim population of the world? 25%. Isn't the Muslim religion peaceful? Hopefully. But that's not really material. There's no doubt that the predominantly Christian population of Germany was peaceful. But under the dictatorial leadership of Hitler, who was also Christian, that made no difference. You either went along with the administration or you were eliminated. There were 5 to 6 million Christians killed by the Nazis for political reasons, and that includes 7,000 Polish priests. Thus, almost the same number of Christians were killed by the Nazis as the 6 million Holocaust Jews who were killed by them, and we seldom heard anything at all other than the Jewish atrocities. Although Hitler kept the world focused on the Jews, he had no hesitancy about killing anyone who got in his way of exterminating the Jews or of taking over the world, German, Christian, or other. Same with the Muslim terrorists. They focus the world on the U.S., but they kill all in their way. Their own people, or the Spanish, French, anyone else. Point here is, and just like the peaceful Germans were of no protection to anyone from the Nazis, no matter how many peaceful Muslims there may be, they are no protection for us from the Muslim terrorist leaders and what they're fanatically bent on doing by their own pronouncements, like the one we heard today, killing all of us infidels. I don't blame the peaceful Muslims. What would you do if your choice was to shut up or die? So who are we at war with? Now, there's no way we can honestly respond that it is anyone other than the Muslim terrorists. Trying to be politically correct and avoid verbalizing this conclusion might well be fatal. There is no way to win if you don't clearly recognize and articulate who you're fighting. So with that background, now to the two major questions. Can we lose the war? What does losing really mean? If we are to win, we must clearly answer these two pivotal questions. We can definitely lose the war. And as anomalous as it may sound, the first major reason we can lose is that so many of us simply do not fathom the answer to the second question. What does losing mean? Now, it would appear that a great many of us think that losing the war means hanging our heads, bringing the troops home, and going about our business, kind of like post-war Vietnam. This is as far from the truth as one can get. What losing really means is that we'd no longer be the premier country in the world. The attacks will not subside, but rather will steadily increase. Remember, they want us dead, not just quiet. If they had just wanted us quiet, they would not have produced an increasing series of attacks against us over the past 18 years. The plan was clearly for terrorists to attack us until we were neutered and submissive to them. We would, of course, have no future support from any other nations for fear of reprisals and for the reason that they would see we were impotent and can't help them. They will pick off the other non-Muslim nations one at a time. It will be increasingly easier for them. They will, as a matter of fact, they actually already hold Spain hostage. Doesn't matter whether it was right or wrong for Spain to withdraw its troops from Iraq. Spain did it because the Muslim terrorists bombed their train and told them to withdraw the troops. Anything else they want Spain to do will be done. Spain is finished. The next probably will be France. Our one hope on France is that they might see the light and realize that if we don't win, they're finished too, in that they can't resist the Muslim terrorists without us. However, it may be already too late for France. France is now already 20% Muslim and fading fast. If we lose the war, our production, income, exports, and way of life will vanish as we know it. After losing, who would trade or deal with us if they were threatened by the Muslims? If we can't stop the Muslim terrorists, how could anyone else? The radical Muslims know full well what is riding on this war and therefore are completely committed to winning at any cost. We better know it too and be likewise committed to winning at any cost. Why do I go to such lengths about the results of losing? Simple. Until we recognize the cost of losing, we cannot unite and really put 100% of our thoughts and efforts into winning, and it is going to take that 100% effort to win. So how can we lose the war? Again, the answer is rather simple. We can lose the war simply by imploding, that is, defeating ourselves by refusing to recognize the enemy and their purpose, and really digging in and lending full support to the war effort. If we are united, there is no way that we can lose. If we continue to be divided, there is no way that we can win. Let me give you a few examples of how we simply don't comprehend the life and death seriousness of the situation. President Bush selects Norman Mineta as Secretary of Transportation. Although all of the terrorist attacks were committed by Muslim men between 17 and 40 years of age, Secretary Mineta refuses to allow any profiling. Does that sound like we're taking the thing seriously, this war? This is war. For the duration, we're going to have to give up some of the civil rights that we've become accustomed to. We'd better be prepared to lose some of our civil rights temporarily, or we most certainly will lose all of them permanently. And don't worry, it's not a slippery slope. We gave up plenty of civil rights during World War II and immediately restored them after the victory and, in fact, added more since. Do I blame President Bush or President Clinton before him? No. I blame us for simply assuming we can maintain all of our political correctness and all of our civil rights during this conflict and have a clean, lawful, honorable war. None of those words apply to war. Get them out of your head. Some have gone so far in their criticism of the war and or the administration that it seems they almost would literally like to see us lose. I hasten to add that this isn't because they are disloyal. It's because they just don't recognize what losing means. Nevertheless, that conduct gives the impression to the enemy that we are divided and weakening. It concerns our friends, and it does a great deal of damage to our cause. Of more recent vintage, the uproar, you'll recall, fueled by the politicians and media regarding the treatment of some prisoners of war, perhaps exemplifies best what I'm saying. We fairly recently, had an issue involving the treatment of a few Muslim prisoners of war by a small group of our military police. Remember that? These are the type of prisoners who just very few months ago were throwing their own people off buildings, cutting off their hands, cutting out their tongues, and otherwise murdering their own people just for disagreeing with Saddam Hussein. And just a few years ago, these same type prisoners chemically killed 400,000 of their own people for the same reason. They're also the same type of enemy fighters who recently were burning Americans, dragging their charred corpses through the streets of Iraq, and still more recently, the same type of enemy that was and is providing videos to all news sources internationally of the beheading of American prisoners that they held. Compare this with some of our press and politicians who for several days in the past thought and talked about nothing else but the humiliating of some Muslim prisoners, not burning them, not dragging their charred corpses through the streets, not beheading them, but humiliating them. Can this be for real? The politicians and pundits have even talked of impeachment of the Secretary of Defense. If this doesn't show the complete lack of comprehension and understanding of the seriousness of the enemy we're fighting, the life and death struggle we're in, and the disastrous results of losing this war, nothing can. Remember, the Muslim terrorists stated the goal, and it is to kill all infidels. That would be us. That translates to all non-Muslims. Not just in the United States, but throughout the world. We are the last bastion of defense. We have been criticized for many years as being arrogant. The charge is valid in at least one respect. We are arrogant in that we believe that we are so good, powerful, and smart that we can win the hearts and minds of all those who attack us. And that with both hands tied behind our back, we can defeat anything bad in the world. We can't. If we don't recognize this, our nation as we know it is not going to survive, and no other free country in the world will survive if we are defeated. And finally, name any Muslim country throughout the world that allows freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, equal rights for anyone, let alone everyone, equal status or any status for women, or that have been productive in one single way that contributes to the good of the world. This has been a long way of saying that we must be united on this war, or we're going to be equated in history books to the self-inflicted fall of the Roman Empire, if that is the Muslim leaders will allow history books to be written or read. No doubt they wouldn't. If we don't win this war right now, keep a close eye on the Muslims, the takeover in France in the next 5 years or less. They're going to continue to increase the Muslim population of France and continue to encroach little by little on the established French traditions. The French will be fighting among themselves, something they do very well, over what should or should not be done, which will continue to weaken them and keep them from any united resolve. Doesn't that sound eerily familiar? Democracies don't have their freedom taken away from them by some external military force. Instead, they give their freedoms away, politically correct peace by politically correct peace. And they're giving those freedoms away to those who have shown worldwide that they abhor freedom and will not apply it to you or even themselves once they are in power. They have universally shown that when they have taken over, they will start brutally killing each other over who will be the few who control the masses. We will never stop hearing from the politically correct about the peaceful Muslims. I close on a hopeful note by repeating what I said above. If we're united, there is no way we can lose. I hope now after the election, this was some time ago, you'll recall, the factions in our country will begin to focus on the critical situation we're in and will unite to save our country. It is your future we are talking about. Do whatever you can to preserve it. Well, since the elections he spoke of, the general spoke of there, obviously we have not united in any very seriously meaningful way. And here we are presented with a videotape from Al-Qaeda of an American telling us face-to-face exactly what this was all about. In other words, either convert to Islam or die. And I recognize that I'm in a nation with a higher than normal Muslim population, mainly radicalized in the South. But you only live once, and you've got to say what you want to say. In my case, those words were not mine, but those of Dr. Vernon Chong, Major General, USAF, retired. But I agree with them, and so be it. You only live once. There is other news that I could go through here, but I think I'll hold the majority of it for tomorrow night. I would like to, I'd like to take some calls. I'd like to get some reaction to what I just read and what is the top story tonight. It's absolutely incredible. Anyway, in the next hour, we're going to be interviewing William Henry, and tomorrow night, Major Ed Dames, who's had a couple of recent hits. And so it should be, all in all, a very, very interesting weekend. There are a number of storms out there, some hurricanes, some typhoons. There is a typhoon that virtually, we think, might have destroyed Wake Island. That would be any building not made of concrete on Wake Island, with winds approaching 200 miles an hour, if you can imagine that. On the first-time caller line, you are on the air. Hello.
Is this me?
Yeah, it's you.
Oh, I wanted to know if what your thoughts were on the goth scene.
I'm sorry, on the what?
The goth subculture.
The what subculture?
Goth, G-O-T-H.
Well, the goth subculture. I don't have any thoughts because I don't know what that is. What is it?
It's a whole bunch of different things. There's a whole bunch of different ideas about what it is. Some people think it's about music. Some think it's about art.
That's probably why I couldn't answer your question. I not understanding what it is, I'm not going to be able to answer your question.
Oh, okay.
I appreciate your hurling it toward me, but and I'll try and educate myself about it, but I really don't know. And apparently you're not fully informed on it yourself. West of the Rockies, you are on the air. Hello. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Bill.
Yes.
Hello, this is a first-time caller, long-time listener.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I am a former employee of Area 51, and about, you know, I'm a little bit nervous, but around April of last year, I had an alien experience, And I've been a little bit too nervous to talk about it, but now I'm able to speak about it if you'd like.
All right, calm down. I'll tell you what, a former employee of Area 51, eh?
Well, I was an IT guy. I was fixing their Unix server, and I had
problems. Oh, all right, that's good enough. So you were working on their computer setup, right?
Mm-hmm, their network and their workstations.
Uh-huh. Okay. What I'm going to do is hold you over during the break, and okay. Believe me, anybody who worked for Area 51, I want to have a little chat with, so stay right there, okay?
Thank you.
All right. Very good. From Southeast Asia, Philippines, I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Well, here I am, speaking Manila, Philippines. The rainy season, such as it is, and we had rain every single day, they call it the rainy season for a good reason, has ended. The sun is out, and there's sort of a little, very little snap in the air, you know, as we might describe it, fall across a great deal of the U.S. It's not exactly fall here, mind you. The sun is out, it's hot again, and fairly humid, but not quite as humid. So there's a very minor snap in the air, and it's clear out there and very nice. In a moment, we'll continue with a caller who claims he worked at Area 51. Rarely does one get the luxury of somebody who claims they worked at Area 51. In the case of this man, he did some important computer work for them. And the first question I have for you, sir, before we get into any detail of what you may have seen, is I would like to know, even to go to Area 51 to do contractual work, the kind of work you did, I would assume that you would have to sign some sort of document saying you'd keep your mouth shut about anything you saw. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And so now here you are on a worldwide talk show about to tell us all about it. Is that correct?
Indeed.
Doesn't that concern you somewhat?
Well, I am currently not in the right state of mind, sir. What the experiences I had at that job that one night that made me say, okay, I'm done with this. I have not been able to sleep, to talk about it, to get any help from my family, psychiatrist, for over a year now. And I was last weekend, I was coming from Fresno for job interviews, and I tuned into your radio station, and I thought, and I felt the courage to say, you know what, I think I'll call in next weekend and talk to him.
All right. You're talking about an area very close to my home in Nevada, just really over the mountain from where I lived and still maintain my home in Nevada. So if you would, please tell us everything that's relevant about why you're here on the radio.
I was not really the network administrator, but one of the network techs. We mostly worked with the security, changing the administrative rights and passwords every few hours. I wasn't able to look at all of them, but I have been able to open up secret documents to change administrative rights on the computer.
Okay, all right, good enough. Do you want to talk about what you saw in them?
Well, it was documents about the encounters of what experiences or experiments they've done with aliens at that place. And they said that the blues and the grays had something to do with September 11th.
They did?
Mm-hmm.
Did they actually describe their involvement? Certainly we pretty well know what happened and who did it.
Well, that's the thing, that the document said that they believed that there was, with the blue and the gray civil war going on, that there had some involvement, but I wasn't able to have the time to read the whole document. But
so they believe there's civil war going on between the blues and the grays?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Did it document when contact between those at Area 51 and those from elsewhere began? Did it document anything about Roswell? Did you get to read anything about that?
A lot of it was encrypted. I did not get full rights, but There was the night that I quit my job, I was abducted. And if you like, I can tell you the story.
All right, let's hear about that night. That night apparently is what's haunting you. What happened that night that caused you to quit?
Well, I was on the graveyard shift. We were backing up files. We have a tape backup device that says every night we back up information on the secret server. And when I went outside to talk to the security guards, I was on my break. We were just having a cigarette or something. We were eating Krispy Kreme donuts. And then what appeared to be a banana-shaped spaceship or something split through the sky, mm-hmm. coming down. And I won't repeat the words I said on the radio station. I'm a gentleman, but
Thank you.
Said some words. I was very scared. Now, there were these smooth ball blue creatures. I'm sorry, I'm really nervous.
No, I understand.
I'm just trying to relax. These small beings, they said, "You are the chosen one, the one who will deliver the message, a message of hope for those who choose to hear it, and a warning for those who do not." Now, what I've been pondering for this year is, what does that mean? And that is one of the reasons why I called you.
So they never gave you the message?
They gave me the message saying, "I'm the chosen one." I don't understand why I'm the chosen one.
You're the chosen one, and there is a message for those who want to hear it, even those, I guess, who don't. But what the key is, what's the message? Or is that where you decided, "I don't want to be a messenger, I'm out of here, I quit"?
Well, if I am the chosen one, I kind of have to be. Kind of, you know, Jesus didn't say, "You know what, I don't want to be the Son of God." I mean, he kind of had to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so for this year, I've been in hiding. I haven't really been myself, and that's why I called you. I was wondering your thoughts on your opinions on what this message could be. Could it be about the end of the world, the apocalypse? Could it be that the world will now know that there are beings outside of this galaxy that want to contact with us? I'm just wondering what your thoughts and opinions are.
My immediate thought is, and I'm sorry you didn't stick around to get the message.
Yeah.
So that's when you quit then.
Yes. I don't know what happened. That just happened. I was so scared. They took me to the hospital. And I was, you know, just in the hospital for a few days. And then when I got out, I contacted my supervisor and I said, "What happened to me that night, I do not want to talk about it. I'm done with this. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. And I am going to move far away as possible. Now I'm in the California area, the Kern County area."
So you're all the way on the other side of the country. All right, well, listen, is there anything else critical that we should know that you found out there?
Well, I was taken up to the ship, and they did a few experiments on me, mostly sexually.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's been repeated again and again, and then you were returned. So do you think any of that, the fact that you were abducted, is affecting what you're telling us right now?
Can you repeat the question, sir?
Yeah. Do you think the fact that you were abducted and those experiments they did to you, is that affecting what you're telling us right now? In other words,
are they mind-controlling me or telling me what I need to say?
Yeah. Do you think you're under some kind of control?
Well, that's what I'm thinking, sir. I haven't been myself lately for the past year.
All right. Well, listen, if anything else occurs to you, you get back to us, all right?
I will. And thank you for talking to me, sir.
You're very welcome. Take care. Somebody claims that he was working on computers at Area 51, saw information to the effect that the Grays and the Blues are in some sort of civil war. But most of all, was about to receive a message, the message, apparently, that we should all know. And did drop the name Jesus. Now, if Moses had, instead of bringing the Ten Commandments down from the mountain, had decided he didn't want to receive the message, nor did he wish to carry it down the mountain and bring it to us, we would not have it today. So I'm kind of sorry that you didn't hang in there and get the message. But I can understand. You sounded very nervous, and I guess I can understand why you would not wish to proceed, although I wish you had. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, this is Charlie from Pennsylvania. Have
yes,
you read David Rockefeller's memoirs?
I have not.
Well, on page 405, he is quoted saying, "Some even believe we are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists and conspiring with others around the world."
That's absolutely correct, sir. I mean, a lot of people believe that of the Rockefellers and
others. World, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I'm proud of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, our president, I mean, is speaking just like Hitler. Can I read a quote, Seth?
Yeah, I suppose so. Go ahead.
See, in my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in, to catapult the propaganta. Greece, New York, May 24th, 2005.
All right, well, thank you very much. I imagine that one day, not in our lifetimes, but one day in the future somewhere, it probably will be one world. After all, we've gone from, what was it in the beginning? The Stone Age, and then tribes. We were tribal for a period of time, and tribes began trading with each other. And then small villages sprang up, and the villages began trading with each other. And then eventually, of course, cities and nations sprang up, and those cities began trading, as did the nations, as do the nations now trade. And now, of course, in our lifetimes, we've witnessed blocks beginning to form. The European bloc, the Asian bloc, the American bloc, or the Americas bloc, if you will. And those blocs are beginning to trade with each other. So if you look at what's happened since the dawn of mankind, I think it's fairly safe to assume that indeed, one day, we're going to be one world. We're going to be a single world of some sort. Let's go to the international line and say, hello there, you are on the air.
Hi, Art. Good afternoon. This is Nena. I'm calling from Richmond, British Columbia, and we have spoken a few times, remember? I was the one who wanted to talk to Ramona.
Yes, I recall.
Yes. The reason why I called is I'll be coming over for a holiday in the Philippines.
Oh, really?
Yes, next week. I wonder if is there a chance that I can invite you and your wife, beautiful wife, for a get-together. You know, I really, really want to see you.
All right. Here's the way to do it. Email me. I'm artbell@mindspring.com. Artbell, A-R-T-B-E-L-L, @mindspring.com. Email me. Let me know what your schedule is, and I'll do the very best I can. That's all I can promise. I'll email back, and we'll see what we can do.
Okay. I'll be there between September 11 and 24. My house is just close to where you live, so maybe I would be lucky to see your wife.
Well, I think it's entirely possible. So you email me, and we'll see what we can do. All right?
Sure, of course. Thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome. Yeah. Take care. As a matter of fact, my wife and I are looking forward to meeting perhaps some other Americans here in the Manila area who are married to Filipinas. And if that would be the case with you and you're in this particular area or you travel through, feel free to contact me. Now, obviously, we're not going to be able to meet with everybody. It just simply can't be done. But should the opportunity arise, we would be more than happy to meet some people in this area, particularly people who are in the same sort of situation that we're in. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
All right, Art. Your
yes.
show is number one on the internet, kid.
Hey, buddy. How you doing?
great. You actually are ranked by TalkStreamLive.com. Congratulations, you're number one. I guess you know
no
that.
No kidding.
Name, right?
You know, that's amazing. I keep getting word of these things that have been happening to me lately, honors bestowed on me, top 25 talk show hosts of all time, that kind of thing, which is pretty cool. And I get it from all of the listeners out there. And so here you just gave me another one. So we're ranked number one, eh?
That's right. TalkStream Live. Also,
where are you located, by the way?
I'm in East Haven, Connecticut.
Connecticut. I know Connecticut very well indeed.
And you're also, believe it or not, you're a big hit on shortwave radio. You have guys who host shows. I mean, you know shortwave radio because you're a big radio guy. Most people might not even know what we're talking about. You're a big hit. You got a lot of fans out there.
Well,
Art, the 9/11 attack was a military operation planned for, trained, and executed within the borders of the United States. And when you get hit within your perimeter, you secure the perimeter. Bush didn't secure our borders. Instead, Bush calls the Minutemen vigilantes, and Bush wants amnesty for illegal invaders inside America. Folks, every enemy of America has their agents in America. They're coming in every single day. They're creating political movements. They're creating fundraisers, i.e. Hezbollah was convicted a couple of years ago of running money laundering business in North Carolina, the home of our Marines. Hezbollah bombed our Marine barracks back in 83.
Well, I just went through all that. John, how would you secure our borders? I mean, realistically, we've got a couple of borders that are full of water, right? Those are tough. And then, of course, we've got a couple of borders that are even harder, that with Mexico and that with Canada. We're a big nation with nothing but borders. How do we physically, how do we actually control our borders? How do we do it?
Okay, and also the airports. First of all, what I would have done, well, I was proposing this before 9/11, but obviously everybody should have been on board after 9/11. I would immediately have contacted every foreign country in the world and tell them, look, you got people inside America with visa violations, their visas have expired. Get your people out of America or you're going to lose visa privileges and we're going to come down on you, whether it's trade, financial aid, whatever it is. We have plenty of aspects to go after them on that. Get them out of here. There would be no more student visas from Muslim countries and no more flights coming in from Muslim countries. Instead, Bush has actually increased to over 30,000, believe it or not, Saudi and Egyptian student visas coming into America. Mm-hmm. That is absolutely sick. I would have immediately sent down the military. You only needed about 10,000 guys on the Mexican border with all our electronics. You couldn't get an ant, wouldn't have been able to move through that border. Then I would have also secured the Canadian border in a similar way. I would have call for a civilian border patrol, i.e. like the great civilian air patrol of World War II, and we did get it with the Minutemen, but it would have been even bigger. I also proposed a new branch to the military. You say, well, that would be big. No, it wouldn't. I would get all these 17, 18, 19-year-old kids who grew up on computers, would have created a cyber computerized military, another branch where these kids would have shut down anything around the world with their great technology and their great know-how. We have a lot of people.
John, I'm not sure, John, that 10,000 military could secure, for example, 2,200 miles of border with Mexico.
Well, I'm talking about actually, that's the initial would have happened. I would be building a wall right there. I'm talking about 10,000 with electronics. They would be backed up by the Border Patrol, National Guard, and even more troops. But I would immediately have had 10,000 down there with electronics to stop any movement down there. Then the wall goes up, a double wall goes up there. Look, Art, I could also propose, I could solve a lot of America's problems. New Orleans is what? It's below sea level. I would have dug a trench right through the Mexican border, took that land, that soil to New Orleans, brought New Orleans above sea level. In that trench, I would have took all the excess alligators in Florida, put it in the trench, put water in there. That would have stopped off the border being overrun.
Alligators.
New
alligators.
Orleans would be above sea level. I'd be solving all the problems.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great minds out here, Art, and we're not going to be suppressed.
Okay. All right, John. I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. I know that Pat Buchanan was recently a guest on the show. I'm not a big fan of all he articulates. America does need immigrants. Make no mistake about it. We are a country that wouldn't be what we are without immigrants. Now, exactly how we separate the wheat from the chaff is entirely a different question, and we need a means and a way to do that. From Manila in the Philippines, Southeast Asia, I'm Art Bell. It is a very good morning, afternoon, or evening to you, wherever you may be in the world. Here the sun streams down mightily on the Philippine Islands. I realize most of you are in the dark, figuratively only. This is a pretty hip audience, actually. Coming up in a moment, author, investigative mythologist. Investigative mythologist. That's interesting, isn't it? And guest host of the popular radio program Whitley Strieber's Dreamland, William Henry, is on a mission to reveal the lost codes of myth and symbols. He specializes in ancient myths of beings that come and go via gates to the stars. His research encompasses parallel universes, something we've been talking a lot about lately, wormholes, and spiritual alchemy. His published works include Egypt, Shadow of Atlantis, Cloak of the Illuminati, Secrets, Transformations, Crossing the Stargate, and Language of the Birds. Coming up in just a moment, William Henry. Well, finally, after all these years, I get to meet and greet William Henry. Welcome to the program, William.
Oh, good morning, Art. How are you?
I am just fine, buddy. It's great to have you on the show.
My pleasure. Very excited. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
I see that an early topic here is going to be weapons of mass destruction, ancient weapons of mass destruction. I'm very, very interested in this because I always had this feeling, William, that somehow, the civilization that we all see around us right now, and we assume it's been the only one of its type, has not been. I have this feeling that there were days in, I don't know, millennia gone past when there was another civilization here and something managed to wipe virtually almost all traces of it away. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I totally agree with that. I think that that likely many, many people believe that as well. It's an intuition. It's perhaps even for some a past life recall. But it seems to be coming to a head now because we're about to launch headlong into the future or an unfathomably dark global war. And these moments seem to bring up these issues of, wait a minute, have we been here before? Is there a better way to go about our current circumstances? How can we navigate through these dangerous times and waters that we suddenly find ourselves in?
Precisely. What evidence is there that there was ever any ancient weapon of mass destruction?
Well, you find the mythological record, the scriptural record offers insights into that question. You have references to actual devices. For example, the Ark of the Covenant is considered to be a holy object, but it in fact is responsible for as many as 65,000 deaths. That's a weapon of mass destruction. And so when we look to stories like that and we compare them with the historical record, it suggests that that's a good possibility that that device was in fact used as a weapon.
Okay, what do we know about the Ark of the Covenant? I mean, what do we actually think we know about it? How did it kill that many? What method? What tell me about the Ark.
Well, the Ark of the Covenant is considered to be simply a golden box about the size of a coffin that was lined with gold inside and out. It the key point in considering it to be some form of a weapon system involves the two tablets of the law that were placed inside of the Ark of the Covenant. It's widely believed by scholars that these tablets may have been in fact radioactive. They were the source of the death beams that came out of the Ark of the Covenant. And they talk about the protective clothing that the priests wore. They talk about references in the Bible, in the Old Testament, to figures who actually touched the Ark of the Covenant and fell down dead. There are recollections in the Bible about the Philistines and how as many as 50,000 of the Philistines were actually killed by Ark radiations. And so we have to take a look at those stories and ask, are they Are they recording literal history? Is this merely an allegory? Is this a metaphor? But I think it's actually history that we're dealing with here.
William, there are a number of stories purporting to know the location of the Ark currently, that it's being guarded in, and I can't remember the country, maybe Northern Africa. I what do you know about the possible current location of the Ark of the Covenant?
Well, what I know about it that brings it into the realm of why we want to study this question is that it's the Islamic people that actually have as much to say about the present whereabouts of the Ark as anybody. The Quran is very specific about the Ark. They say it's located near Lake Tiberias. And the reason that the Islamic Mahdi or Messiah figure will be known is he will show the way to the Ark of the Covenant. He will bring the Ark to light from a place called Antioch. And of course, there are some Islamic scholars who believe that these the relics that will be discovered there will include evidence of Moses and the people of Aaron, and there might be scepters of Moses, Aaron's rod, the place of the Torah. And they talk specifically about Osama bin Laden as being a key figure who may be presently attempting to step into the shoes of the Mahdi and actually be the one who will locate the Ark of the Covenant, which would have disastrous effects on the world stage if that were to happen.
Yeah, certainly if it contained that kind of nuclear material, you bet. How much weight do you really give to all this as being possible?
Well, I think it's entirely possible. I think going back especially to the mid-90s when I started looking at the Saddam Hussein story and his relation to the Ark of the Covenant and this sort of end-time script that some political and religious figures on the world stage today seem to be attempting to fulfill, we watched with just open jaws, literally, at some of these moves that these people are making, and it lends a lot of credence to this notion that, hey, there are people that truly believe this, and not only do they believe this, but they are acting on the fulfillment of these prophecies.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I was going to ask next. Do you think there are a number of people, let's say on both sides, that are sort of racing to fulfill these prophecies?
Yes, and that's exactly, that forms the context of our present world era. You have on the one side what we are labeling Islamic fascists who are attempting to fulfill these prophecies, and of course the Islamic fascists turn around and say, well, you're the Christian barbarians. The Islamic fascists seek to convert everybody to the Book of Allah. The Christian barbarians, according to the Islamic fascists, want to convert everybody to the Christian book of Jesus. And neither will stop until they have fulfilled their prophecies to the letter. And what that means is that Western civilization hangs in the balance. And for some, this isn't just an earthly battle. This is actually a cosmic battle, because when you scratch the surface on the beliefs of some of these individuals, they claim and make statements that they are actually guided by divine intervention, that they are acting on behalf of God. And so here we have this very tricky and dangerous situation unfolding as a consequence.
Well, I know, but the Christian world really is not saying to the Islamics, look, convert or die. I suppose there could be that perception on their side, although it's not articulated from our side. As recently as in the news right now, we have a converted American saying exactly that, convert or die.
Right. Yeah, and I agree that it's not overtly stated, and I'm not implying that that's our policy either, but when you do look at it, it suggests that the world is to become one single book, one universal religion, and at the moment, there are two primary religions that are vying for the mantle or the title of having the universal religion, Christianity and Islam.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that a one world, religion, if not government, and maybe they go together in the end, is inevitable?
I do. I absolutely think it's inevitable. And what I think is going to spark it is when we look at images provided by, for example, the Hubble Space Telescope, we look at a field of galaxies, hundreds, if not thousands of galaxies. And the issue that comes up is as we look out into the stars, we don't necessarily see Jesus or Buddha or Muhammad or Allah. We don't see any of these traditional religious figures. All we see is this massive unity. And when we look back at Earth, it provides this tremendous overview effect, and it suggests that we are moving to a phase here where we are preparing to transcend Earth life as we know it, and that what that means is we're going to transcend religion as we know it as well. And what we're going to begin to embrace is more of a galactic type perspective. We're going to understand that we are children of our galaxy who are visiting this Earth temporarily, and that there is, in fact, a universal code of understanding out there.
Well, William, looking around the world right now, I don't see that understanding settling in very well.
No.
Across the world. It's going to take something massive and gigantic to begin a movement of that sort. How do you see it happening?
Well, I always like to point people to the book of Isaiah. It refers to a time when what may be interpreted as enlightenment will spread across the world. It refers to a time when the light of the sun will increase by seven times and the light of the moon will increase by seven times, and a new vibration, if you will spread over the planet. It's curious to me that statement comes from Isaiah 30, 26. Isaiah 30, 25 gives us a clue about when this increase in the light or enlightenment will occur. And it says it will happen after the towers fall.
After the towers fall. Well, if the light of the sun increased by seven, there'd be universal death.
You got it. And that's why it seems to be more of a metaphor for enlightenment, for a new vibration coming on the planet. And this is what so many are looking for in the 2012 prophecies, is this idea of a new light, a new vibration, a new body of knowledge that's beginning to emerge on the planet, that maybe even coming from the center of our galaxy itself. At least that's what the Maya talk about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's certainly edible, but a literal seven times, of course, is not.
Oh no, we're scorched, we're fried. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we're fried. That's Ed Dames all the way.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so the Ark of the Covenant may have been a weapon of mass destruction. Do you think that it was simply, as we believe, to protect the contents of the Ark? Is that why it was so?
Well, in addition to, it was a communications device that kept the Israelites, the high priests, in communication with Yahweh, the Israelite God. And so it served many purposes, actually. But primarily, when you look at the Ark of the Covenant and the way it was carried into battle, the Egyptians had what appears to be a forerunner for the Ark of the Covenant that they too carried into battle. So it seems as if its primary function was to be a protective device.
William, looking at the world as it is today, the great cities of the world, the New Yorks, the Chicagos, the Los Angeleses, on around the world, all these great cities, can you imagine in your mind anything that would be so completely, utterly destructive, even over a period of millions of years, that there would be virtually nothing left for some future race to discover and say, my God, there was a great civilization once?
Is there such a weapon?
Yes.
Well, I would say it's likely going to be some kind of a space-based weapon, something on the order of, say, Tesla's death ray that would just absolutely annihilate the planet. Of course, we've got enough nuclear warheads right now to do the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is do we have the most destructive weapon of all, and that is a human brain that is tuned to this frequency that would stoop to such terror and such what we might even in fact label as evil?
Oh, I think clearly. There's a number of them walking around. And as we just talked about a moment ago, there are people telling us either convert or die. And obviously we're not going to convert, so we're in a war. We're in a war to the death, aren't we?
We are in a war to the death, but we also have to recognize that it's a spiritual war as well. And that's the primary role that every single person listening tonight, as well as around the world, I think is going to have to awaken to that the only way that we can really maneuver through this situation is for individuals to take increased responsibility for their own life and their own well-being, and to, in fact, and this sounds sort of new agey, but we have got to shift away from terror into terra. It's complementary or flip side. Terror means something, which means preying on innocent people, but the phonetically similar term terra means compassion and enlightenment. And what we have to do is flip the vibration from terror into terra. And we've got to begin to find ways where we can reach out and begin to manifest terra as opposed to terror.
Okay, but really, when you dissect your message, it's also saying, in the end, you're going to have to convert to some sort of new universal enlightenment or die. Convert or die. Same message.
You're right. That is a very good analysis, and I'll accept that, because it doesn't mean that we have to leave behind the old religions of the books permanently. It means that we have to utilize them. I mean, there was a time when before Christianity, there was a time before Islam, there was a time before Buddhism, and all of those seem to be stepping stones, if we use them properly, that will lead us into the stars. And that's the point that I'm trying to make, is that we know too much now about science, we know too much about the universe to argue about religion. And it may sound like a fantasy, but I think we've got to find some way to show the world all of the benefits of this enlightened perspective. Because once you have this perspective, you're not going to behave the same way. You're going to find new solutions as opposed to reverting back to the old paradigm of attack and of terror.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how you feel about the possibility of alien observation, and then even beyond that, depending on how you answer, I guess, how you feel about the possibility of alien intervention, should we begin a war that would obviously result in the end of it all?
Well, when you study these devices, the ancient weapons of mass destruction, we recognize that many of them have connections with beings that say they came from the stars, that it asks us to consider that outside entities, for example, that the Gnostics called the Archons or the Nephilim of the Bible, lurk
yes.
behind the scenes and are either egging us on, in other words, helping to provide us these weapons of mass destruction, or they're viewing our present situation, our present circumstances, as some form of a test.
All right. Well, in the last few weeks, William, we've been discussing the possibility of other dimensions, and I know this is something that's occurred to you as well. It does seem impossible for beings to come from other star systems unless they have a technology that allows them to go faster than light, a lot faster than light, William. But somebody coming or something coming from another dimension or through a wormhole would seem to us every bit as much a star traveler, an alien, as if they had come from another planet. So how do you feel about this? I mean, modern physicists, scientists, theoretical physicists are talking about 11 or more dimensions, right?
Right. Well, there's, of course, support for the idea of wormholes in the scientific community. The real challenge, as you said, is how do you explain how to engineer such wormholes big enough for practical use? And it suggests that maybe there is a race of beings that has answered these engineering questions. As I look back in the ancient record, the primary source of inspiration for me is the visual record. Art, I'm just astounded when you look back at various, for example, Egyptian depictions of the gods. They show the gods, Ra, for example, riding on his ark or bark of the millions of years, which he sails into eternity. And very often, Ra is shown on this ark sailing into a gate of stars. And I call that a stargate. But here's
right.
the incredible thing is that the shape, the design that the Egyptian artists used to portray the ship of Ra is exactly the same way that Stephen Hawking describes a wormhole today. And the question that I pose is, how is this possible? Is Stephen Hawking and Brian Greene and Michio Kaku, are these guys reincarnated Egyptian priests and using this ancient symbolism? Or is modern science tripping upon an ancient sacred primordial science of the gods, which is focused upon traveling the stars through stargates and wormholes?
Well, I would vote for the latter possibility. Hold tight, William. We're at the bottom of the hour. William Henry is my guest. I'm Art Bell from Manila in the Philippines. This is Coast to Coast AM. One has to wonder if this great conversion, this singularity, will occur when modern theoretical physics and modern science suddenly collide with what we thought was myth and ancient nonsense. Well, more and more these days, these two things are beginning to, they're coming towards some sort of juncture. And when it's all proven and we know the entire truth, I wonder if that's when the great conversion takes place. Chris in Bowling Green, Kentucky says, Art, please tell me the name of that song you just played in that break. It's been driving me crazy since the first episode of Dead Like Me. Nobody can tell me what it is driving me crazy. Thanks, Chris. Well, it's called Boomba, Chris, and it's by a group called Matisse and a young lady who's, I believe, half African or is African. A very, very intriguing song. And that's exactly where I found it, Chris, was in an episode of Dead Like Me. And then after I mentioned it, they used it in yet a second episode, which I'm sure you'll get to see since it's replaying presently. We've talked quite a bit about that. Once again, here's William Henry. William, what do you think about that, one day modern theoretical physics, as articulated by people like Dr. Kaku and others, and in fact science, will collide with and at least verify those portions of myth that are true, and that is when this great conversion will take place, and not before then, until we can put our hand on it, and it's more than myth.
Yeah, I just about came out of my chair when you said that, Art, because that is so clear and so concise of an analysis. That's exactly what I see is happening. And the only way that we begin to understand ancient myth is by figuring in advanced theoretical physics. Over and over again, we come across stories of gods coming and going through these gates.
Yes.
And the notion is that once human technology passes a certain threshold, the singularity, as it's called by singularity enthusiasts, we're going to enjoy the kind of powers and pleasures traditionally assigned to the gods or beings in heaven, limitless lifespans, if not immortality, superhuman powers, virtually limitless wealth, fleshly pleasures on demand, and ultimately access to the gates, the wormholes that theoretically traverse the heavens.
Is there much evidence that there at one time or any time was immortality?
Well, I think so, because it was such a dominant theme of especially the Egyptian religion. I live here in Nashville right now. I have the benefit of the Quest for Immortality exhibit, which is a collection of artifacts from Thutmose III, who's considered to be the founder of the Rosicrucians and some of the mystery schools such as the Great White Brotherhood and others. And what we see here is this deep focus on immortality, and it seems that they did actually achieve immortality. And every time we look at these stories associated with it, we see that familiar wormhole shape, and we see in particular something very important that's missing from modern theoretical physicists' approach to immortality through wormhole travel, and that is modern science focuses on the out here. They focus on how are we going to find the exotic matter that's going to open the throat of the wormhole? How are we going to protect the human going through it? The difference is that the ancients focused not on the exotic matter in the wormhole itself. They focused on the transformation of the human preparatory to entering that gate. And that's a critical difference that we don't see exemplified in many of the texts about wormholes and traveling through Stargate.
What kind of preparation would they have done to move through a gate like that?
Well, they describe it, first of all, as entering the field of the blessed, which is a really powerful word to me. When you talk about a field, you're talking about a plane, but you're also talking perhaps about an energy field. And what they sought to do was to match their frequency, their vibration, with this field or dimension of the blessed, if you will. And this is why I feel that we see so many examples in ancient art of gods standing in the gate. It's almost as if they're in some kind of a decompression chamber, an intermediate realm between the earthly world and the heavenly world. And what they're trying to do is match their frequency with the dimension of the blessed.
Boy, bingo, William. Something else we've discussed on Coast for now, actually a couple of years. It began with a discussion of the shadow people. I'm sure you know about that. These are beings or spirits or entities that we can sometimes occasionally get glimpses of. Some people claim to have seen them full on. And, you know, frequency is involved in this. And I've had a theory that modern computers and modern monitors, for that matter, which we spend many of us spend hours and hours and hours staring at, operate at a certain refresh frequency. Now, after you've stared at a computer monitor long enough, your brain, I believe, begins to change a little bit and adjust itself to that refresh frequency. And it's just different enough, William, that for short periods of time, people who have stared at monitors long enough begin to see other things that they would not normally see. Now, does that mean anything to you?
Well, absolutely. I mean, just in the sense that I always like to, and I'll introduce it here, I always like to put forward a phrase from a quote from Terence McKenna. He says, "We are like caterpillars contemplating pupation. No longer will I chew on the cabbage leaves. No longer will I spend my time moving around on the underside of the foliage. Life must be a preparation for the transition to another dimension." And if, in fact, our civilization is transcending or transitioning into another dimension, it would make sense that the tools, the technology is going to be around us at all times. It's going to be ubiquitous. And I think that that's a good testimonial, what you're offering there, to this idea that while we appear to be using the computer for one purpose, it's actually tuning us into this other dimension.
That's right. And I think we're beginning to get glimpses of it. That's what I think is beginning to happen. We're starting to get little glimpses of it. And sometimes it's done even without the aid of a computer adjusting our brains a little bit. You get more and more of it. People who say they've slipped from here to there for a very short time and then back again. I've heard a million of these stories. It's what we were talking about last weekend. And so there's something going on, and it definitely is related to frequency. So I'm with you all the way on this one. I'm not sure where it's headed, but it's happening.
It is happening, and it's all around us. And one of the other key things that goes along with this ancient Egyptian and Sumerian and other artwork that I study, and this idea of humankind being in a pupal phase right now, a caterpillar prepared to transform or transition into a butterfly, is that again and again there is a cloak or a garment that is involved when figures go into these gateways. A classic example is the story of Elijah going into the whirlwind at Gilgal. He turns to his priest, Elisha, and transmits to him a garment. And whether that is a literal physical garment or if it's a teaching that enabled Elijah to match the frequency of the whirlwind, let's call it a wormhole, and enter the other dimension, we're not sure. Teaching? Actual cloak? I don't know. But today, what's happening with this singularity we're talking about is there's this convergence of these four key technologies: genes, bits, neurons, and atoms. And through the confluence of these technologies, which are all becoming one, it's all going to be focused on the human body. because while right now we wear our computers, in the coming years, next probably 5 to 7, more and more we're going to see that human skin is in fact the platform where these technologies are going to converge. And what we're going to be doing is creating a new cloak or garment for humankind.
Are you familiar with the name Robert Bigelow?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Robert Bigelow is a good friend of mine. He recently did an incredible thing and launched a spacecraft. It's going to eventually be a hotel in space. That's what he's doing right now. But Robert Bigelow had a ranch, and I still won't identify the location, where a number of anomalous things were going on, William. And a couple of witnesses using night vision equipment, again, looking at frequencies that our eyes normally would not be able to see, both reported seeing, believe me, I'm telling you the truth, both reported seeing with night vision some kind of hole suddenly appear, a hole of light, and they saw a creature crawl through it, some kind of creature crawl through this hole. And again, there you have it. Somebody using equipment that enabled them to see with their eyes something they would not normally have seen, night vision equipment, and they actually witnessed a creature crawling through some kind of, I don't know what to call it, some kind of hole.
A gateway.
A gateway, yeah, a gateway. That's as good a word as any.
Absolutely. More and more, Art, I hear this. I have people contacting me. There's a site in northern Michigan, extreme northern Michigan in the UP. I've been contacted about a site in Arizona in the Phoenix area where they're reporting these incredible anomalies. And these sites, the difference that separates them from other sites is that there are accredited scientists presently involved with studying and measuring what's going on at these sites. And I can't say a whole lot more about either of them because I've been asked to keep some of it private other than to describe it generally. But this is happening right now. And I would expect that within the next couple of years, we're going to see more and more evidence of these gateways. And we're talking about scientists from brand name universities who are involved, who are starting to take this very seriously.
Can you talk at all about the nature of what was, let's see, how can I put this, the nature of what was seen or experienced with these gateways without telling me?
Yep, very similar to what you're describing. I've been sent videos that show what appear to be craft coming and going through these gateways.
Really?
There's always this notion of the bright light, the hole, the tunnel of light that opens up, and objects seeming to come and go from those holes in space, those points of light.
Really?
Mm-hmm. It's absolutely stunning.
This really is stunning, and it's major universities doing the research?
It's individuals from major universities, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I know one gentleman is writing a book about this site in northern Michigan that's going to be out later this year, if not early next year, with scientists from the University of Michigan involved.
Wow. I would certainly like to know more about that, and ask me if I'd like to have them on the radio.
Absolutely. Well, you know, this goes to a proposal that was put forward in the 70s by a philosopher named Dr. Oliver Reiser. He put this forth a theory concerning the memory field, and he argued that Earth is really a living being, a giant creature, an egg, with the plant and animal kingdoms forming on its surface. And he viewed the eastern and western hemispheres as analogous to the right and left hemispheres of the brain. And together, what he says is they're spinning out lines of force, wires, if you will, that are weaving an electromagnetic society, a field, a new
mm-hmm.
field, maybe even the field of the blessed that the Egyptians talk about. And he thinks that Reiser thought that all of human history was aimed at awakening of this planetary brain. And it suggests to me that maybe that's what we're seeing in these hot spots that are suddenly becoming so amazingly prevalent and relevant, because it could be that our new technological influence that's happened just in the past 50 years is wiring the brain of the planet. And so what we're starting to see at these instances are the equivalent of neurons that are firing, but also gateways that are opening up.
Boy, there you go. So you think it's possible that ancient gods did travel via these stargates?
I'm personally convinced of it, and it's very personal, too, because the same Egyptian god, Ptah, that is credited with the creation of the craft of the gods, and I use that word craft very intentionally, is also, according to Egyptian hieroglyphic dictionaries, responsible for the creation of the human body. In fact, Ptah's hieroglyph has a double helix written into his hieroglyph. Traditional Egyptologists say it's nothing more than twisted flax, but it's clearly a double helix. And so it suggests to me, and this is the point of focus of my research, is that the human body is designed as an interface with these gateways. And this is why it becomes such a transitional phase in our civilization once we wake up to this idea that these gateways are real and that this is, in fact, the original sacred science of the gods.
And the double helix is the key?
And the double helix is the key. I believe that embedded within our DNA are the instructions for making this transition. And a key quote that I always like to use comes from Jesus in the Pistis Sophia, and I'll just paraphrase it, where he says, "Don't do anything except find the purifying mysteries that will transform you into a being of pure light so that you can inherit the light of my kingdom."
Wow.
That's a very specific mission statement about why we're on this planet. It is to absorb these teachings, to transform ourselves into a being of light so that we can inherit the light of the kingdom. And I interpret the kingdom not as an earthly place, but as the garden of hundreds of billions of galaxies that inhabits the known universe.
How do you view Jesus? As a teacher, as Muhammad was? Or, I know, a touchy question, but...
Yeah, very touchy question. I certainly subscribe to the Gnostic perspective of Jesus, where we are to absorb this knowledge. I believe that he was part of an esoteric research group that had scoured the ancient world, including Egypt, Iran, Iraq, India, and were focused on bringing these teachings together that transforms an ordinary mortal into an immortal being. And it's a very more scientific-based perspective than traditional Christianity, but it's one that leads me into this belief that, hey, you know, when Jesus took a couple of disciples up to the Mount of Transfiguration and transformed his clothing into light, that he was demonstrating this ability that we all have within us to effectively transform ourselves into beings of light.
Do you have any idea of course, the scientists talk about 11 dimensions. If one were to be able to move through these stargates, what do you imagine would await on the other side? That's a really hard question.
It's a different levels. Great question, actually.
Okay.
And one place that I begin to look at an answer for that is a place, and again, we're in Egypt, we're in the tomb of a pharaoh, again, Thutmose III, and we have this book written on the walls. It's called the Book of the Amduat, which is the Egyptian term at this time for the underworld, for the field of the blessed, the afterlife of the soul. And as we watch the initiate climb aboard his craft, which again is shaped exactly the way modern science portrays a wormhole, we find that various guides manifest. And that is one of the first things that I would suggest that we would experience, is that once we open this gate, if not before, there will be guidance. And whether or not these are beings in a body or incorporeal beings, or if it's actually guidance coming from within our DNA, that guidance is there and, in fact, will assist us along the way. In fact, the Egyptians were quite benevolent about this. They show in this book, which portrays, again, the initiate going through 12 gates to a new dawn, a new beginning, they show souls that literally do get lost in the cosmic ocean, and they have beings that are there to fish these beings out. This is the origin of the whole myth of the Fisher King that rescues or saves the souls who suddenly got lost or drowned in the cosmic ocean.
As you know, we've mapped our DNA. In that mapping, the scientists have come up with something called junk DNA. Now, they call it junk DNA because they can't figure out what its usefulness is, if any at all. There are people who believe that the so-called junk DNA actually contains critical information. Have you looked into that at all?
Just beginning to, actually, it brings to mind an important point. We keep talking about the singularity, and some think that's an impossibility or it's very far off. We have to remember, for perspective, that when we first started decoding the human genome, it was thought that it was going to take thousands of years to actually accomplish that.
That's right.
And we did it in, what, 2 decades?
Yes.
And so I think that this goes to this whole idea of accelerating change. But my focus primarily is, I'm not a geneticist, and so I'm looking more at the myths and the stories and saying, you know, if you're a theoretical physicist or a geneticist, you really want to go back and take a look at what the Egyptians have on their temple walls and what they're saying in some of these books, because it's loaded with references to the process of human transformation, which is what it's all about.
Got it. William, hold tight. We're at the bottom of top of yet another hour. We'll be right back with William Henry. I'm Art Bell. Certainly is. My guest is William Henry. Somebody or another said that any technology sufficiently advanced would appear to us as magic. It seems to me that any technology sufficiently ancient as to be regarded by us as a myth would also appear to us as magic. Ray of Golden, Colorado says, you talked of crafts and animals coming out of a gateway that was light. When people die, they say there's a light that could be the soul going into a new dimension via a gateway. William, do you think that might be the same light?
I think there's a very good possibility that bright white light experienced by people who have the near-death experience are in fact encountering the gateway. In fact, that's one of the interpretations of the ancient story of Jacob's ladder, when he scaled the ladder that went into the heavens and went to a higher, finer place and came back to earth and said, this is none other than the gate to God, and this is the gate to heaven. So I think that's mm-hmm. a very good assumption.
All right. Moving along a little bit, you talk of spears of destiny, that Himmler had one, Saddam had one, and America, in fact, has one.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with Himmler. What is a spear of destiny?
Well, the traditional thought on the spear of destiny is that this is the spear that the Roman centurion Longinus had at the crucifixion. He uses the spear to poke Jesus' body hanging on the cross and outspurts the blood and water, the transformed blood and water coming from his body. And afterwards, this spear disappears into myth and legend, but it now becomes called the spear of destiny. And the legend is that whoever controls the spear of destiny controls the destiny of the world. And so you have all of these various researchers that point to this literal artifact, a Roman spear that's kept in the Habsburgs Museum in Austria. But in fact, when you research Heinrich Himmler, especially his place called Heinrich Himmler's Camelot, you find that Himmler himself had a very different idea about what the spear of destiny was. And he portrays it as a long rod that looks like an arrow tip, that is, in fact, a massive SS facility that was intended to be a library. It was going to be a research facility. But what it encodes is this ancient belief that the true spear of destiny is, in fact, some kind of a device that may have at one time been responsible for opening gateways into other realms.
And there's evidence that the Nazis were working on something based on this technology?
Absolutely. There's no question now that based on research that's been coming out ever since World War II, that the Nazis were into some very exotic physics and some very exotic science. And we couple that with the understanding that they were also deeply, deeply interested in the ancient world. And we come up with what appears to be a match between their science and the source of many of these ideas, the ancient world.
Okay, then move forward to Saddam. And apparently there's some sort of satellite photograph of a clock tower built by Saddam in Baghdad, which it says is a virtual carbon copy of Himmler's Spear of Destiny. Is that so, and why?
Well, it is so, and it was absolutely mind-blowing to me when we first invaded Baghdad back in 2003 and these photos became available. It was part of Saddam's ceremonial center. And it seems that what these people do once they, and we also have to, first of all, acknowledge that Saddam was deeply interested in these the occult history of ancient Iraq. It appears that once they recognize this knowledge, that they build these constructions that essentially become sort of like flagpoles for those in the know that they've apprehended this knowledge and are now prepared to actually use that knowledge. And I think that what happened is that Saddam recognized that this clock tower that he built was a perfect place for him to portray his understanding of this ancient technology, and he himself created a Spear of Destiny that is an absolute ringer for Himmler's. Why is it that they are identical, virtually mm-hmm. identical? Mm-hmm. I think because they're describing a machine, a device, a particle accelerator. And the reason why they're so similar, it's sort of like if you and I suddenly started researching transportation, we came up with a model for an automobile. Our designs would be strikingly similar because we're apprehending the same body of knowledge.
Well, this may be reaching, but as we all know, prior to the latest Iraq war, we all thought maybe we were duped in thinking that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. Perhaps he really had some. Or could it be true that Saddam, or in Saddam's mind, he thought he had in the Spear of Destiny some kind of weapon of mass destruction, and that is in fact what he was talking about, that which we never found?
Oh, I think that that's a absolutely accurate statement, that Saddam understood the value of this ancient knowledge. He was gathering thousands upon thousands of ancient Sumerian tablets. He had opened the Saddam Hussein School for ancient cuneiform studies. He was creating museums dedicated to the Anunnaki gods of ancient Samaria. He had called the Berlin Museum, requested the return of the Ishtar Gate of Babylon. He had called the British Museum, wanting copies of the tablets that the British had taken out of Iraq during the 19th century. All of this in an effort to create what I call a Disneyland for the Anunnaki. He was creating this massive database of ancient knowledge, and the focal point of it, I'm convinced, is this knowledge about ancient technology, and especially the secrets of the gods, especially the secrets of the gates of the gods.
Well, I wonder what happened to him. I mean, if he had had real weapons of mass destruction, surely when he saw us coming at him, he knew that was the ball game, and so he would have used them. He did not. So he must have been woefully disappointed in the Spear of Destiny because we found him hiding in a little hole in the ground.
Well, that in itself was scripted. And the script that they were following when they did that is the script of what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. Saddam, as we all know, or many of us realize, connected himself with Nebuchadnezzar, the ancient king of Babylon, mm-hmm. who himself was deeply interested in the occult knowledge, especially that concerning the Tower of Babel, which was the original gate to heaven that was destroyed by the Israelite god Yahweh. And so when you follow that script of Nebuchadnezzar, he had opened what is described as a fiery furnace in the book of Daniel, which has all of the hallmarks of being a gateway story. Three men, three wise men from the Temple of Solomon, entered the fiery furnace and mm-hmm. came back out with the Son of God in tow. And if we take out fiery furnace and put in frequency or gate of vibrational gateway, we right. have what appears to be a Stargate story. After Nebuchadnezzar and the three wise men opened this gate, the watchers came down. And it's often cited as a punishment that Nebuchadnezzar was forced to eat grass. And this is why Saddam was put in a hole because the Iraqi people understood his connection to Nebuchadnezzar. They understood that after Nebuchadnezzar opened the gate, he too was forced to eat grass. And so when they show Saddam as this wild man-looking prophet, this is tearing a page right out of the book of Daniel and aligning him with Nebuchadnezzar. But in fact, in the Nebuchadnezzar story, when he opened that gate, he wasn't, I don't think, punished, because the book of Daniel also says that his body was covered with the dew of heaven. The dew of heaven is the soma. It's the elixir of immortality. It's what a lot of this is about from the alchemical perspective and other traditions. So I believe that what they were actually doing was opening a gateway, and what Nebuchadnezzar was, in fact, he was rewarded with immortal life after that.
Do you think that Saddam never properly mastered the old techniques, that he never properly understood them or applied them, or what happened?
Yeah, I think Saddam is a sort of the cargo cult version of these original biblical prophets. It's one thing to assemble the tools and the knowledge about these tools, vis-a-vis the tablets, the Sumerian tablets and cylinder seals that he was collecting. It's another to actually begin to apply them. And it seems that maybe there is some otherworldly guidance that protects this knowledge, that keeps those who really need to keep their paws off them to keep their paws off. And that's, in fact, what happened with Saddam.
Good.
Yeah.
Now, America's Spear of Destiny. We've got one in America, and apparently near you, yes?
Yes, here in Nashville, Tennessee, where I live, there's a 2,200-foot-long magician's rod that's laid out on 19 acres that is a match for Saddam's Spear of Destiny, Himmler's Spear of Destiny, as well as the earliest prototype of this Spear of Destiny, what is called Meru, the cosmic axis, the ladder to heaven.
And this is a this is located just very near you. You visited this place, I take it?
I've been there a couple hundred times. I actually give tours of it. It is at the base of our state capitol. I actually found it after I was tracing FDR's quest for the Holy Grail in Mongolia in 1934. The clues, the evidence that I was following led me to Nashville as the possible repository for some of this knowledge. We all know that Tennessee was intricately involved in the Manhattan Project, and it has this kind of history of setting up mystery type cities like Oak Ridge, and it looks like Nashville may be another of these sites. I was encouraged in some of this by Graham Hancock and Robert Bavall. They had this amazing book called Talisman, Sacred City, Secret Faith, and they talk about how certain cities around the planet, notably Paris, Washington, D.C., London, are being used by secret societies to transmit sacred knowledge, and the medium is the architecture of these cities. Well, Nashville, Tennessee is a virtual carbon copy of ancient Athens. We have a Parthenon here. We have a scale replica of Athena's Parthenon, the Temple of Holy Wisdom. We have a Temple of Mars. And we have this 2,200-foot-long magician's rod that is a spear of destiny. And it appears that Nashville is one of these talismanic cities that it's being utilized by whatever group to encode and transmit this knowledge.
What is the current state of ancient groups like the Illuminati and so forth? What are they today?
I really don't have direct knowledge of what they are today. I see a proliferation of symbolism in our world, especially ancient symbolism. And when I see that, I'm thinking, okay, these are the old Illuminati tricksters here that are playing their games. And I do believe that there is two factions of the Illuminati. You have the Illuminati that seem to support humankind, that want to see us to match the level of the gods, even exceed their capabilities. Then you have the other faction that is more comfortable keeping us at the level of slaves and sex objects. And so it appears that that is part of the context of our our global situation right now. And the question is, are we going to disintegrate into a world of terror, or are we going to ascend into a world of terror, compassion, and enlightenment?
And all of this seems to depend on the singularity that you were talking about. Is there any way to know in the larger scheme of things how really close we might be to some kind of singularity? I mean, if you look around the world today, it does not, on the face of it, seem close. I mean, there are hints that we're moving in, but they're only hints at this point.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is as singularitarians, as they're called, they talk about the exponential growth that continues to accelerate during our time, and that ultimately the challenge here is that while scientific knowledge is growing exponentially, humankind still lives in the linear world, so we don't see all of these massive changes that are in fact happening in the background. An example they often cite is the internet, that went from just tens of thousands of users over a two-year period in the 80s to suddenly a decade later, now there's 80 million people using the internet.
Absolutely.
But the jump in between was, it happened linearly, but it was an exponential growth. And so that's what we're looking at here, is there, we may be in the midst of seeing an incredible explosion of this knowledge here in the coming years. And where I focus people's attention is the U.S. military, because what we have is this word that's bandied about. And if you listen for it in speeches by the Secretary of Defense, by the Secretary of State, and even the President, the key buzzword is the word transformation. And when you apply it to the military, they talk about force transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I think what they're trying to do is force transformation, especially in Iraq. You can't force transformation in this context. But force transformation, what it refers to is this development of the new suit of battle armor for the U.S. military, which is going to be comprised of the confluence of these technologies. We're literally creating a new skin for the U.S. soldier, the future warrior, that's being rolled out in stages. You're starting to see it in Iraq now, but by 2010 is when they expect to have this new superhuman battle soldier ready to go.
Yeah. I've been hearing a lot of under rumors about that. How much can you actually tell me? I understand there is a new suit of armor coming, that it's going to seem superhuman.
Yes. In 2003, the U.S. Army gave MIT $50 million to begin development of this new suit of battle armor. They opened up a facility at MIT that's focused on using nanotechnology to make this these new soldiers resistant to ballistic attack, to chemical attack.
Right.
They're using, also they talk about literally activating superhuman powers within these soldiers. And so when you go to Department of Defense websites and you might look up like Future Warrior, you'll actually see examples of these suits or models of these suits, and it looks like something right out of Star Wars. They look like Darth Vader, to be perfectly honest.
I guess we're also going to have to be able to eventually control the weather, and the weather can certainly be used as a weapon. Is there any indication that... Are there myths saying that the ancients were ever in control of that which we cannot yet control, the weather?
I haven't seen anything in that regard, but that is, as you mentioned, one of the key steps here on that, the Kardashev or Kaku scale of the Type 0 to Type 1 civilization, where we're trying to step into that phase right now. The interesting corollary to that is we are a Type 0 civilization right now, where our civilization is powered by dead plants and dead dinosaurs. And the corollary that we make is with the five stages of our relationship with God. The first begins with a master-to-slave relationship, and that's basically the relationship most people have with their deity. The deity is the master, and they are the slave or the servant of that deity, be it Jesus, Allah, whomever. When we ascend to a Type 1 civilization where we're capable of modifying the weather, that corresponds to what is thought of as the mother-to-child relationship with God. This is the relationship between Jesus and Mary. And that brings about a subtle change in our consciousness, because now we no longer seek to rape the resources of our planet. Instead, we seek to live in balance and in harmony with it. The next...
All right. Well, Dr. Kaku gives us not very good odds of going from type 0 to type 1. When you really press him on the issue, he's really negative on the possibility of our ever making it to type 1. And he's talking constantly about the need to colonize other planets if the human race is to continue, the implication being that, of course, that we're going to destroy our own planet.
Right. Well, and it's because, and this isn't a slight, but I haven't sensed in his writings that Dr. Kaku is coming from a very spiritual perspective. Not that he's not a spiritual person, but he's coming at it from a straight scientific perspective. And it seems that if we can begin to develop this cosmology that allows crossing between the worlds, then more and more we're going to see people access their own deep biospiritual powers that are latent within our DNA. And that's what will begin to really make the shift. I mean, right now in the 3D world, this is the way you get things to happen. You have an inspiration or a thought, you add emotion to it, but then it takes a lot of effort to make something happen, lots of time.
Yeah. The question is how quickly we're going to have to make this transition or end up as nothing more than a William Henry of the future sometime, talking about us as a myth and wondering what we were like. Hold on, William, we're at the bottom of the hour. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Singularities, wormholes, but especially that singularity and things that were known then that perhaps are not known now. Although a little caveat to that, I wonder if the modern witch, and I've interviewed a number of modern witches on this program, know more about what we've been talking about this evening than, well, most of us do. I'd say that's a possibility, because much of what they say sounds like much of what we've been hearing tonight. We'll ask William Henry about that, and we'll begin to take some calls even this hour. So if you've got questions about what you've heard, you know how to get to us. I'm Art Bell. William, I want to give you a chance to promo some things that are coming up. The Bay Area UFO Expo, it happens every year, September 9th and 10th. I understand John Lear is going to be there. Now, I thought he had kind of gone into the background, but here he is again along with Nick Begich and I guess yourself.
I'll be there. Yeah, I can't wait to hear John Lear and reconnect with Nick. I've known Nick for 10 years now, and Danian Brinkley will be there. They've got a wonderful roster. It's one of the best shows I do anywhere. I always look forward to it, but especially with some of these folks that haven't been around in a while.
Boy, that's John Lear for sure. I thought he had stopped talking, but here he comes again. Awakening the Temple of Light Conference, September 16th, 17th, Nashville. That's close to home.
Yeah.
And Signs of Destiny, November 18th and 20th, with Russell Targ and J.J. Hertek. Wow.
Yeah, that's another wonderful conference. Dr. Chet Snow puts it on every year in Tempe. This will be my fourth year in a row to do it. And again, a phenomenal experience out there. Great time to be in the Phoenix area and with Russell Targ and J.J. Hertok. I just can't wait to be in part of the audience for that one.
Yeah. I said something coming out of the break that I want to follow up on, and that is that I've interviewed a lot of, modern alchemists, witches, people like that, and they talk an awful lot about the kinds of things that you've talked about tonight. Do they understand more about all of this than the average guy on the street?
I think so, Art, and that's the reason why I carefully use that word craft. When I'm referring to the ships of the gods, I call them their craft, because when you look up the word craft in the English dictionary, it refers to certainly a ship, but it also refers to a skill, a device, a power, and
that's
also
right.
To magic. And this is what we're dealing with here. And the craft originally was about the transformation of an ordinary human into an immortal being, preparatory to entering the gate of the gods and riding upon the ship of the gods for eternity, the wormholes.
There you go.
And of course, Freemasonry calls their skill the craft as well.
Indeed they do. First time caller line, you are on the air with William Henry. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, this is Doug. I'm calling from Wisconsin.
Right.
Yeah, I'm just calling because I had I've had several visions, but one really powerful one I had was right before the U.S. Army entered Iraq. And I was working, right in the middle of work, all of a sudden, I was worried about the fact that, you know, that he was going to use weapons of mass destruction. Everyone said when he was going to use them was right when they invaded Iraq.
That's right.
In Baghdad, actually. So they were ready to invade Baghdad that morning, and I'm standing in work. All of a sudden, I have this vision, and all of a sudden, I'm really huge, and I was about, like, chest level, looking down on the city of Baghdad. I put one hand on the Tigris River, one hand on the Euphrates, got, like, this electric charge from both of those. It energized me, and Saddam Hussein, like, walked right through my heart, and I could feel this negative energy that he had, but it was like a personal power. I saw him as an orange flame, but I saw the soldiers as blue flames, and I saw them as like angels surrounding Iraq on three sides, or Baghdad on three sides. And as he came through my heart, I felt his energy, and I felt it got kind of getting absorbed into mine, and then I felt this peace and calm and tranquility that it wasn't going to happen, and the weapons of mass destruction were neutralized.
Mm-hmm. Well, something certainly. I don't know if they were neutralized because we haven't found them, but Dr. Rink from Las Vegas notes here, William, Nazis and Saddam both got their asses kicked and their countries ruined. Hardly an example of harnessing the occult and becoming victorious.
Well, the fact is that I didn't say anything about using it to become victorious. I think they both were deeply steeped in the occult, were using that knowledge. And it's possible that both examples, when you follow the path of history, that this exotic technology, perhaps even occult technology that the Nazis were using, well, those scientists were scooped up and brought to America. What happened to perhaps all of this occult knowledge that was stored in the Iraqi National Museum that was looted? Well, some believe that that was actually a stage operation where the U.S. military went in and scooped up this knowledge. So in both
instances, with regard to the Nazis, actually, I think we pretty well split it up with the Russians, didn't we?
Yes, we did. And but some of it did come here, and so I can't totally agree. I mean, I'm not certainly supporting the Nazi use of the occult knowledge or Saddam's use of it, but that knowledge is very useful, and to the extent that they were able to actually produce a victory with it, no, they certainly did not, but that does not discredit the usefulness of this knowledge.
Uh-huh. All right. Wild card line, you're on the air with William Henry. Hi.
Hello, Mr. Bell. This is Casey calling from Tennessee, and hello, William.
Hi.
I just wanted to call because it just so happened that the show came on tonight as I was going to finally take that next step, a cross-country journey that I feel like has been calling me for quite some time. And, William, you're speaking of the Spirit Destiny in Nashville near our capital is quite enlightening. I wonder if after the show, maybe if you had enough energy, maybe you'd like to meet me at the Spear of Destiny and join me on my journey across country and become my highway companion on the way to enlightenment of, I don't know what I really am going to do or have to do, but I know that I have to do something. This has been going on for a long time. I won't go into it, but let's just say that my mind is completely made up that I have something that I have to do. And I just wondered, you know, I'm by myself here. I wonder if you'd like to come along with me on my journey and find out if this is the time for the truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate the invitation very much. I'm on my own parallel path, and so perhaps we can run side by side there. I can't say that I can join you, but I certainly wish you, as they say, Godspeed on your journey.
Yeah, I know the feeling he has, though.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess you do, too. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with William Henry. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I'm Roz from Minnesota.
Yes, Roz.
I had an experience in October of 2001. I was reading the Bible, and I had never read it before, and I just had the New Testament, and I read things that are not in the Bible, and my heart broke. You know, I was so involved in the story and about how they killed Jesus, and I felt my heart break, and it started talking directly to me. He called me Phoebus. It was very strange.
Well, I think a lot of people feel that way when they read the Bible, but I'm not sure what you meant by you began reading things that were not in the Bible.
I know that the things, some of the things I read are not in the Bible. And it was like the things I read, I would think an answer in my head. It was like it was speaking directly to me. Mm-hmm. And Jesus called me Phoebus. Introduced me to others, and asked if I would give up everything to help him. And instantly my children flashed through my head, but I was so heartbroken for him, and I thought, yes. And he said, welcome. He said he was coming back. They wouldn't allow him into heaven. He was coming back, almost to the beginning. The vessel they were traveling in was shipwrecked. They ended up getting to shore. Some friendly people there allowed them to sit at their fire. They were looking for firewood. Jesus got bit by a snake in his ankle. And then I felt like I was supposed to stop reading. I stopped reading. I slept for a couple hours. I woke up. And I sent somebody to buy me a whole Bible, because all I had was the New Testament. And I started at the Old Testament. And this was a woman's Bible. And after some passages, it would have notes by famous women. And as soon as I started reading, it got to the part where the snake offered Eve the apple. And after that, it stopped, and there was a note by, I think it was Mother Teresa.
Roz, I hate to press you, but do you have a question for William Henry?
Have people had this happen before, where they've read things that are not in the Bible?
Okay, in other words, the Bible is an interesting question, actually, William. Is there a transformational quality to the Bible itself, when you know, in the reading of the Bible, is there a transformational? Is it the document that people believe it to be? I guess I can ask it that way, William. Or is the Bible a nice story?
Well, no, I think that the Bible is an amazing collection of vibrations and frequencies, really. And if you can tune into some of those stories, I've had similar experiences such as that, where I feel like I've been transported to the place. And mm-hmm. This can just be simply because I have an active imagination, or I'm a creative person, or whatever. But the other point that goes along with it is that everything external to us is but a mirror of our inner selves. And so when we're in the Bible or any other sacred text, or in myth and any other myth, we're engaged in the story because we're looking for knowledge about ourselves. And so very often when we look into those texts, we can see things that other people don't see, because it's we ourselves who are looking at it, and we're looking into a mirror.
When one reads the Bible, William, you use the word myth. How much of what is in the Bible would you ascribe to myth not to be believed versus myth with a grain of truth or whole truth?
Well, both, actually. I mean, the thing is about the Bible that I've noticed is that it uses tremendous shorthand all the time. Moses was trained in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. What? What does that mean? Like, he knew who built the pyramids and how, and what's buried in the Hall of Records? Where does this stop? And another example that I like to cite involves Mary Magdalene. One of the things that we don't understand is the meaning of the word Magdala, which means tower. There's this amazing literary, mystic literary tradition associated with Magdala that is assumed you know about when you read the story of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Mm-hmm. Problem is, most people don't know about the mystic literary tradition of Magdala and how the women of Magdala were known for having knowledge about the workings of the heavens, the language of the angels, the language of the birds, and the language of the archons. They knew how to change a person's heart. They could go out of their body. They could travel the heavens. So unless you know that that's the mystic literary tradition of Magdala, you totally miss the story of Mary Magdalene.
Okay.
And that's why I say there's a tremendous mythic component to it that doesn't mean it's not true. It just means that they're talking in shorthand and making references to mythic events and to other historical events that you've got to gain awareness of.
Got it. East of the Rockies, now you're on the air with William Henry. Hi.
Hi. This is Paul from Amarillo, Texas.
Yes, Paul.
And I do a lot of the same things you do, William, with, you know, researching cultures and stuff, except my basis is the ancient Norse and some of the Celtic.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of extreme parallels that we're, you know, I'm hearing from, my own research. Excuse me. But I got a quick story that might actually kind of fit into all of this. I was doing some Galdr, which is rune magic, and I was with a group. Now, our ritual site was a mile from our hall, if you will, and everybody was staying in between. After the ritual, everybody left, and me and the other person who was doing the other part of the ritual, we stayed, and then we walked to the hall. Well, the interesting thing was we got there before everybody else did. And what they saw was two shadow people walking down the path to the hall. And so Galdr, the rune magic, is all about intonation and changing your body frequency.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so,
yeah, that's exactly what we've been talking about, actually.
So we were able to change our body frequency, enter another state where we didn't leave footprints in the snow. You could see, and it was snowing. We could see every single snowflake in perfect detail, absolute clarity. But we got there twice as fast as they did. They didn't see us go by. They saw two shadow people on the path.
How many stories like this have you heard of, William?
Well, I hear them all the time. Actually, I travel a couple, three times a month, and I'm always interacting. A lot of the coast-to-coast audience comes out to my talks, and I hear stories like this all the time. And what people are looking for is a context. What does this mean? Why am I experiencing this, and what do I do with this knowledge?
I think we're getting closer to some kind of understanding about why people are having all of these experiences. And I know they sound crazy when you just sort of open up to them, as we do on this program. And I said this last week, they sound kind of crazy, but something obviously is going on. And it's going on now with increasing frequency, if you'll pardon this sort of half pun there.
Mm-hmm.
Increasing frequency. And it sounds wild, it sounds crazy, but there's no denying that something really is going on. There's more of whatever it is that you've been talking about, that the scientists have been talking about, beginning to come through. It's as though the veil were slowly is slowly lifting, and we're just getting more and more of whatever's out there.
And I think it's going to accelerate. I mean, next year, 2007, couple of events. We've got the Large Hadron Collider opening up, and physicists are talking in terms of mythic terms, like entering new territories, like Christopher Columbus, and talking about new realms, new physics, new dimensions, and new particles, and all kinds of things like this. This is a brand new world that we're entering into, and it's tremendously exciting.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with William Henry. Hi.
Hi. My name is Jonathan, 570 KVI Seattle. I'm wondering, William, what do you think about the whole 2012 golden age theory? Is it a golden age or apocalypse or neither?
Well, I really like the whole idea of 2012 as a moment of cosmogenesis, to borrow John Major Jenkins' term, and I've locked on to his interpretation of the Maya prophecy that talks about the opening of the black hole at the center of our galaxy and a serpent rope emerging, and the way what John believes is a valid interpretation of that prophecy is that we can take out the archaic Mayan term serpent rope and insert the modern word wormhole, and we have what the Maya were describing. And so I've actually collected, I've got half a dozen, six, eight maybe, depictions of feathered serpent beings that correspond with what the Maya say is going to emerge from that wormhole in other ancient cultures such as Egypt and Sumeria. And you'd be surprised at how they correlate with these beings riding upon serpents in the stars. And we ask the question, are these serpents that they're riding through the stars actually wormholes? I believe that they are. And we're right on the verge of opening up that primordial sacred science.
And I was wondering, on a political level, what role do the Illuminati play in manipulating world events like the 9/11?
Okay.
Again, that's a little bit out of my specialty. That's more of a David Icke question. What I try to focus on is, what is the knowledge that the Illuminati doesn't want us to have? And what they don't want us to know about is the tremendous power enfolded within human DNA to transform ourselves into angelic-type beings.
All right. On that note, William, hold tight. We're at the top of the hour. What exactly is the Illuminati's knowledge, that very secret knowledge that they don't want us to know? Is it of the singularity? I'm Art Bell. Tonight's ride, courtesy of William Henry, we're talking about old myths that perhaps have modern application. I don't know. It's all very interesting. The Illuminati, what did they know? What secret knowledge did they have? We'll look more at that in a moment. Once again, William Henry. William, you know, it's kind of interesting. Years ago, I've been doing this program so many years now, people used to call me up and say, you are a member of the Illuminati, aren't you? And you're trilateral, and you're this and that. And I got so fed up, and oh, CIA, I got so fed up with answering that question that I finally gave up, and I started saying, yep, sure I am. And so you can go to the internet now, and you can put in my name and Illuminati, and you will find endless pages of Art Bell's symbols with the Illuminati. I actually know damn little about the Illuminati. Tell me what you can of them, William.
Well, I actually began, of course, you run through the typical sort of material, the David Icke access of material and so forth, but I went to the English dictionary one time and I looked up the word Illuminati, and it referred to a newly baptized Christian initiate. They were called the Lumen Ones or Illuminati, and they were actually given a taper, a lighted candle, as a symbol of their illumination. I wrote a book called Mary Magdalene, the Illuminator, because she was called the Illuminati in the 13th century. And so I started to see that there's this whole other take on the Illuminati as a group of beings that seek to bring about an awakening of human consciousness. And the farther you dig into the ancient world, the more you bump up against beings, for example, the Shining Ones and others, that possess this tremendous scientific knowledge that's focused on these gates. And there are part of these beings that seek to withhold knowledge of these gates from humankind. Remember when Adam and Eve were evicted from the Garden of Eden, Yahweh placed a gate at the garden with two cherubim on either side and a flaming sword in the center to prevent our return. When we tried to rebuild the Tower of Babel, that was an attempt to rebuild the gate to God. But once again, Yahweh decided he didn't want company, so he smashed our tower and separated humankind by language and changed the meaning of Babel from gate to mean confusion and nonsense. And so you see these two sides lining up throughout history. One side of them wants to open the gate. The other side wants to withhold knowledge of the gate from humankind.
Which side are you on at the moment? You want the gate opened, and are you really sure you want it open? Are you sure that we're ready for it to be open?
No, I'm not. I don't want to hedge on this, but I continually wrestle with this, and I can see why they might withhold some of this knowledge, because a particle accelerator capable of opening a stargate or a wormhole can also be a weapon capable of shattering the entire planet. And so I see a certain benevolence in this in terms of putting the brakes on it, that this knowledge, this transformational knowledge, call it magic or the craft, whatever term you want to use, is not for everybody. It can fry people if they're not ready. And if a person is not coming from the right heart space, you got real problems. And vis-a-vis Adolf Hitler, Saddam Hussein, other figures that have tried to utilize this knowledge.
In the wrong way. Okay. Wildcard line, you're on the air with William Henry and Art Bell. Hi.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, this is James from Indiana.
Yes, James.
I had a one quick question, then maybe a theory. I was just wondering, you know, even if you're operating, if your body's operating at a frequency that could protect you somehow from the gravity forces of a singularity, how would you fit through something the size of an atom?
Your body wouldn't. That's the message. See, theoretical physicists are saying, well, it's impossible for us to engineer the opening of a hole large enough for the human body to squeeze through. The human body won't squeeze through it. The human body is an interface for what the early mystic traditions referred to as our divine particle, our sacred nucleus, our seed atom that's within us that we might even think of as our soul. And so from the soul's perspective, the human body is merely an interface that enables the soul to travel through the gate. That's what my research has revealed.
So you're talking about the actual energy that's within us?
Yes.
Okay. And just somehow transporting that to another vessel?
Exactly. And again, this is where theoretical physicists get hung up. They want to focus on, well, if we could open the mouth of a wormhole large enough, then we'd have to have some kind of protective material to line the tube of that wormhole with to protect the human body. No, the human body is not designed to go through these. This is why it's impossible. But the human body is the interface that the soul can use to open those gateways.
Okay. And then just a quick theory that I've had for about 10 years now. This is largely based on, you know, life's experiences, testimonies from others, including my family. And it involves... This will kind of be in the defense of God, you know. I don't know what your views are on that, but you know, as far as demons go, you know, like I've learned through, you know, church and everything, and you know what the Bible says about them, and it says that, you know, one demon alone possesses more knowledge and wisdom than all of humanity combined. Now, would it be possible that demons, you know, even in the Bible, they've had interaction with the human race even as deep as the Nephilim go, right?
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't it be possible for them to also have undergone some impartation of technical knowledge, say 2,000 years ago, to the ancient Egyptians, you know, where because there's evidence, right, you know, that they had a working knowledge of electricity and its principles, advanced engineering concepts as seen in the pyramids, and, you know, astronomy and advanced, geometric principles. I mean, would it be possible that some impartation of knowledge took place there?
Oh, I absolutely think so. And that's what I think we're seeing in this visual code that you see in the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Book of the Amduat. So many of these other temple depictions portray God stepping through these gateways. They actually portray apparatus that are involved. There's one device that I've been studying called the Osiris device, the Osiris pillar that you see at a place called Abydos in Egypt, which is the gate to the underworld, the gate to the nether world, the other realms. And so they clearly had this technology, and somebody brought it here. At least that's what Egyptian myth describes. They talk about formless beings that came out of the cosmic ocean that created human civilization on Earth, on an island of the egg, as they call it. They talk about a relic that was utilized by these beings as sort of a creation device. They talk about these formless beings taking on human bodies and how the civilization developed, nearly suffered a cataclysm, and that this relic was deposited in a repository and reclaimed. And so we see this story played out over and over again, and it appears that this knowledge was brought here a long, long, long time ago.
Well, it's very important, I think, for the audience to understand that these were not just artifacts of a belief system, that in fact, as you just mentioned, they really did have a lot of technology. And as a caller mentioned as well, this technology was real. It should not have been available to them then. They should not have known all of that then, and yet they did.
That's right. In fact, I'm going to Egypt again in January with John Anthony West to look at some of these from John's perspective, this place in particular, Abydos, which is next to the Osirian, that John's convinced is a temple that may be at least 12,000 years old, probably a lot longer. And what you see on the exterior wall of this temple is what I call the logo for the enterprise of this temple. And it is a device that Egyptian myth and legend said could drill holes in space. And so based on that, we have to ask, is this device a literal tool, technology, appliance, or is it simply a symbol for a collection of sciences that these beings possessed? I think it's all of the above, actually.
Okay. Well, that should be an interesting trip, and you're going with the right guy. East
Absolutely.
Of the Rockies? Yeah. East of the Rockies, your turn with William Henry. Hi.
Hi. This is Connie. I'm originally calling from Daytona Beach, Florida, but I'm originally from... Hello?
Hello.
Hi. I'm originally from Virginia, the mountains of Virginia and the foothills of Tennessee.
Okay, Connie. Do you have a question for William?
Yes, well, actually, I have. I know where there is one pyramid. I've seen it myself at the foothills of Virginia, and it goes from the ground. My brother lived at the base of it, and you could stand in his yard, and you have to look straight up. I mean, straight up into the sky to see the top of this mountain, and he says that there's three more. About five miles apart, right where he lived at, and he has found artifacts. I mean, he has found jewels that is twice as big as your fist because he tilled the ground, and he grew gardens, and he would dig up and plow up emeralds and rubies and sapphires. I mean, they were as big or bigger than twice the size of your fist.
Well, there you go, Connie. There have been discoveries, and William, I'm sure you are aware of this, there have been discoveries all over the world of pyramids that have sort of just, I don't know, as they uncover and do work for modern structures, they suddenly uncover these apparent sacred sites and these pyramids in different parts of the world, not just Egypt.
Right. I believe in this whole idea of this network of pyramids throughout the planet that are working with the ley lines, the energy lines of the planet, and that the ancients did possess this technology where they could network or gang these pyramids together as perhaps a power system or even a communication system.
Must have been something, William, because how in the world could it be the entire world? In other words, sure, maybe it's something the Egyptians developed, but now we find pyramids in Central and South America, we find them in Asia, we find them even in the United States, and so... somehow, there had to have been some form of communication at a time when people could not get from here to there or talk from here to there.
Right, and this is something, I have a new book coming out later this year called The Dimension of the Blessed. And what I started noticing through the years is that, especially when you're beside pyramid sites or other teaching facilities, they're always talking about this field of the blessed, this dimension of the blessed that accompanies this place. And I'm talking about Teotihuacan near Mexico City. They talk about that place as the place of the gods, and they called it the place of reeds, the place of the blessed. And then you have the same thing in Egypt, an identical temple layout with the pyramid in the same place, the same myths, and it just, you get this idea that, okay, they're telling the same story and over again, because it's very important, and it is the key story that we want to focus on.
And how could it be? Right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with William Henry. Hi.
Hi, guys. You know, in answer to that last statement that you made, or just an extra statement, perhaps the world was really populated, greatly populated, with very sophisticated people long, long ago. So not just little isolated areas. This is Denise. I'm in Oregon, and I wanted to tell you a story, Art.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you're one of the little characters at the end, I'll tell you. My mother and I were sitting in her kitchen one night, and I was getting ready to say goodbye. And, of course, the lights are on in the kitchen, and the windows popped out at the back of the house. And, you know, when it's light inside, it's pitch black outside. You can't see. It's about 9:30, right. 10 o'clock at night. And all of a sudden, it's as though an elephant dropped out of the sky. She has huge trees in the backyard, and it's as though something that was mammoth dropped out of the tree. And it had to be bipedal because it passed the window, boom, 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 running. I mean, took off running. And behind it was this noise, bing, 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 shooting, as though someone was waiting for whatever this was that fell out of the tree.
And was shooting at it.
And they were shooting at it. And then all of a sudden, there was no noise at all. And, of course, we were transfixed. I mean, the minute this elephant fell out of the tree, we were transfixed. Our eyes were locked.
I would have no idea what that was or what it was.
Well, it isn't that I don't know what it was. It was that I looked at her and I said, did you hear that? And she said, yes. And I said, what was it? She says, I don't know, but you've got a heck of an imagination. You've been listening to too much of Art Bell. And I said, well, if you heard it, then you have a good imagination, too.
There you go.
So my question to William was this. Wormholes. Maybe they can be programmed to particular designations. In other words, the operator of a wormhole perhaps can decide where he's going to land.
Yeah, that would certainly be, that makes a lot of sense.
I don't think I have one in my backyard is what I'm saying.
Are you saying a literal elephant dropped out?
No, something
like as if an elephant, okay, yeah.
Yeah, it was huge. It was so huge. But I don't think it was this dimension because we didn't see light, but we heard it. But the shooting that went on, and we heard the feet hit. I mean, hit so hard, it was as though, I mean, the thing had to be mammoth, whatever it was.
And you think it was cloaked, in other words, it was invisible?
It had to be, because we saw nothing. We were so transfixed because it was so huge, so obviously huge.
Yeah.
And then within seconds, it was gone.
Yeah, this whole cloaking business is really intriguing to me. When I started talking about this future warrior suit that the military's developing, they're also building a cloaking device into that.
Oh, yeah.
And the idea has been presented, well, if they're talking about a cloaked soldier in the open literature, that perhaps they've had this technology for a good while. And I've heard of people in Arizona and elsewhere where they claim they have encountered cloaked military people. So maybe this whatever it was, that this object that you're describing, this cloaked object, has this capability, and perhaps can tune itself in and out of whatever location it feels like going to.
And you think that wormholes maybe perhaps can be programmed to certain designations by the operator?
Right, and that's the whole idea. The big question is, well, okay, so we open a wormhole. Now, where do we go? Sirius? The Pleiades? The center of the galaxy?
Medford, Oregon?
All right. Thank you very much. So much of what we talk about on this program, William, whether it's Bigfoot, various creatures that are seen and then seem to just sort of disappear right in front of people's eyes, or so-called alien craft that are there and then suddenly they're invisible, they're just gone. So much of what we talk about that we call the paranormal on this program, William, seems really to fit in very neatly with the concept of other dimensions and things kind of coming and going, whether it's via a wormhole or it's some sort of natural variance and occurrence in all that is.
Right, and I go back to what Terence McKenna's statement that the whole mission basically of our life is to learn to exist in other dimensions. And so when we're seeing these demonstrations, it should be very exciting to us, because this is something that we're certainly capable of doing as well. And in fact, that may be a big part of what we're all about. Life must be a preparation for transition to another dimension. And I just get excited when I hear things like that, because it says, okay, this is a school, this Earth school, and what are we here to learn? Well, we're learning to achieve a state of lightheartedness so that we can enter these other realms.
Well, I have eternal curiosity about these other realms, William. Just eternal curiosity, and somehow it all mixes together for me. And that's I wrote a book called The Source, and that's sort of what it tried to say, that all of these things, these strange things that are reported on this program and others, are really sort of single-sourced. I don't know. Anyway, my guest is William Henry, and we've got one more segment to go, so everybody stay exactly where you are. From Manila in the Philippines, way out here in Southeast Asia, I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. The Egyptians certainly did not fear the Reaper. They sought him out. They figured ways to aim themselves right in his direction. Osiris, was it? Hi there, everybody. William Henry will be right back, as will I. Once again, William Henry. Jason in Olympia, Washington asks, in the creation of multiple subatomic black holes, kind of like a collider experiment, is it possible for the event horizons to cascade or cross tunnel, pulled by gravity, the net singularity being large enough to capture larger atomic scale material? Is it possible when we get a big enough collider, William, that we'll get a big surprise?
Yeah, it's very possible. We talk about building these giant space-based particle accelerators or atom smashers, these colliders. And, you know, when you go back and you look at the early Sumerian stories about Tiamat and Marduk, this figure who smashed Tiamat with his arrow and this world exploded, we have to wonder, as scientists began to wonder back in the 70s, is it possible that the Sumerian tale is describing a black hole? And that something went terribly wrong with this black hole and created this cosmic catastrophe. And you look at that and say, well, that could very well be a warning for present theoretical physicists.
Well, they say, no problem. We can create little black holes, no problem. We'll see. First time caller line, you're on the air with William. Hi.
Hi, Art. This is Ann from Oregon. And
Hi.
It's so nice to have you back.
Thank you.
I've listened to your programs about chemtrails, and listening to William talk about manipulating DNA and creating a new skin, is it possible that an attempt to do this is a use of chemtrails?
It could well be. I mean, I don't have any direct data about that, but if the Maya are correct and they are talking about this new light, this new vibration that is trying to come upon the planet, is it possible that there is a force out there that seeks to prevent that light from coming in? And so they put up these chemtrails that act as a shield of some kind. But we also have this possibility that these heavy metals or the metals from the chemtrails are seeping into our skin and altering us. So it's something that's a little bit outside of my range, but I'm very curious about it.
I'm curious too. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with William Henry.
Hey, good morning, people. My name is Count Duco from Miami. I have a question about evolution. I wonder, do you guys believe in evolution? Because I have a different take on it. I believe that we come from monkeys to humans and maybe angels and God. What are your take on that?
Evolution, okay.
Yeah, I think that's a a very key component of this. In fact, earlier I mentioned this confluence of genes, bits, neurons, and atoms, these four technologies coming together towards the creation of this new skin. There's a researcher, David Deutsch, who talks about the confluence of four areas of knowledge: quantum physics, evolution, computation, and knowledge, that are ultimately going to lead to this new point of creation. So certainly this whole evolutionary debate debate about evolution is a key piece to this whole puzzle.
I've always thought that evolution and creation could go hand in hand. I just never saw a problem. They argue and argue and argue and argue. But why is it not possible for the hand of creation to be involved in evolution?
Sure. And why isn't it possible for humankind to evolve to the level of the angels, too? I mean, I think that's a lot of what this
that's
is about,
right.
is keeping
right.
us in, down on the farm.
Mm-hmm. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with William Henry. Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Great conversation, gentlemen. This is just great. I had so many different things I want to say to point on everything that you had talked about. By the way, this is William from Detroit, CKLW 800 AM.
Yes, sir.
First thing I wanted to mention was how earlier in the program, he mentioned the Illuminati and how there seems to be two facets, one that wants to help us evolve into the transcendent life, basically take us to the next evolutionary step of humankind, and the other that seems to want to oppress it. They're almost actually one and the same. And how that would be, it's kind of like in alchemy or in magic or in any group situation where the goal and the aim is the same focus, and you have a leader or a directive, and the rest of the devotees are the ones who go through the motions. They all reap the rewards, but there'll be those who above who will transcend a little further based on the hierarchical scale and where they're at in the midst of the change itself. So they're kind of one and the same, and that's basically how symbolism works in much of the esoteric and occult sciences, which brings me to the next statement slash question for your guest, and I'm sure he's aware of this, but are you aware that pretty much everything that was talked about from every different aspect of belief or foundation could be related to a system right now that is also used by the Jews, the mystical Jews, the Kabbalah, where as we progress scientifically into understanding different realms of energy, and the more sensitive our instruments, the deeper we go. And we find out that they all deal with two things, wavelengths and, well, basically vibrational wavelengths.
Frequency, yeah.
Frequencies, there you go. And every tradition speaks of this. You get it with colors. Different vibrations bring different colors, different vibrations,
correct.
Geometrical shapes. Well, this is basically the transcendence or the culmination of an age, and every tradition will speak of it differently, that we're basically on the cusp of right now. As we progress scientifically, it's almost like the difference between a whistle and a dog whistle. If our ears were sensitive enough, like a dog, we'd hear the whistle.
Right.
So basically everything that, you know, basically I guess the question is your guest aware of this system that he's speaking of is in the sciences?
Okay, we're starting to lose you. You're on a portable phone or something.
I mean, it is. I'm in the back room, so I didn't interfere, and it's actually interfering. I'll stay.
I see.
And it's, be honest with you, Art, this is not too different to what Aaron speaks about, Aaron Donahue, although...
I know. Whether it's Aaron Donahue or it's a modern witch, it's all very close, William.
Yes, I am aware of the Kabbalah, and I appreciate the call from Detroit. I grew up in Birmingham, Michigan, so it's always nice to hear from the hometown there. And I think it is all about tuning, and the human body is a instrument that is meant to be tuned to the highest possible frequency, and we do this through the food that we eat, the thoughts that we think, the air that we breathe, and it all comes together. And I certainly encourage people to look into these mysteries from that perspective, that this body is meant to be a tool of ascension for our soul. And what we see as we have these conversations about the Illuminati is so many times they're trying to control and manipulate the input and the output of this instrument, of this body. And literally the body is an energy device. Jordan Maxwell calls it a cell. And this is why when a person is put into a prison, we put them into a cell. It's because our body is it's all about energy, it's all about vibration and who's going to control it, who's going to manipulate it, and for what purpose.
Okay. East of the Rockies, you're out of your little cell and on the air with William Henry.
Yes. Hello, Art.
Hello.
Yes. All my best to you and Aaron and the immediate family.
Thank you.
I have a question tonight pertaining back to the Nazis. I'd like you to possibly touch on the symbolism of the swastika. Also, the lightning bolts that were worn on the collars. And I'm thinking, if you have this same perspective, that this type of symbolism may have given power to the Third Reich through some sort of occult divination. And I'll get off the line to let anybody else get on and love you, Art, and God bless you. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Thank you. William?
Right, of course, yeah, the Nazis were masters of propaganda and the use of symbolism. They understood the power of a symbol, using the lightning bolt to energize themselves, the swastika originally being a symbol of prosperity, which then they turned and inverted. It just sparked this whole incredible notion about what was going on at that time. We have to remember that at the same time the Nazis are invoking their symbols, in 1935 is when FDR put the all-seeing eye on the back of the $1 bill.
That's right.
This is not by coincidence. These are two, I'm not calling FDR a magician, but the purpose in putting that symbol on the back of the dollar bill was to have a magical purpose. It was to align the American civilization with the meaning of that symbol, which is the return of the light to the planet, to Earth. And so I just always marvel at the use of symbols in this way. And it's tremendously important for us to learn to read the language of symbols, because otherwise we're blind to what these groups are actually trying to use us for.
Okay. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with William Henry. Hi.
Hi, this is Keith from Sedona, Arizona, Streamlink listener.
Yes, Keith.
My question goes way back. I have a past life memory of the war that blew the fifth planet into the asteroid belt and devastated Mars. I believe it's the same conflict we're in Iraq. Can you talk about what the Sumerians and others have to say about this? And I'll see you at the expo and George Norrie as well.
Okay.
Oh, beautiful.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, this is the real service that I think that Zachariah Sitchin performed, is in his interpretation of the Sumerian texts, and some take issue with them, but he did bring forth this idea that, hey, there was an Atlantis story in the stars that happened a long time ago and involved the splitting of a planet and also the cataclysm on Mars, and it looks like the same players or at least certainly the same script is trying to be enacted today on Earth, where we're developing these tremendously powerful technologies that can leave Earth hanging in the balance and cause another one of these incredible cosmic catastrophes.
Okay. West of the Rockies, time's getting short. William Henry with you.
Hi, I'm Rachel.
Hi.
Hi. I am up here in Lander's Inn. I'm cleaning these stones, okay? I do believe I am Rachel from Genesis. I found a lamb, and I believe it's a scepter, and I've been cleaning it other than other stones that I've been cleaning and just picking up. Now I've picked up stones with writings on them. Now, I have full intention on finishing this. It's a full-size, it's a decent-sized lamb. My question is that I have this feeling that by actually cleaning this ancient world, this stone, not just this one, but many other ones that I have gathered, it will make this change that you speak of, sir.
Okay, well, there's so many people with, with past life memories, with thoughts about other things, kind of things we've been talking about, William Henry, and she's another one.
Yeah, and I think it goes to this whole idea that we're trying to transcend some of the, call them errors or mistakes of the past, that this stuff comes up because it needs to be moved beyond. And that's what we're in the process of right now, is I think in this global war on terror, where we have these two sides lining up, what we're trying to do really is transcend something within ourselves, and we're bringing it forward in this very negative way. But ultimately, we have to focus on a simple question, and that is, how will we know when we have won the war on terror? That is never given as a suggestion. We know the war on terror will be over when. We knew when World War II was going to end with the defeat of the Nazis and the defeat of the Japanese, and now the War on Terror is being compared to World War II, but there is never a target that is given for us, and that's what
perhaps when the light comes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fourth wildcard line, you're on the air with William Henry. Hello.
Good evening. I just wanted to tell you how much I enjoy your program, and especially tonight, because it validates so many of what those of us that are coming out of the closet feel like, just the paranormal mixing up with science and finally saying it's real, and
that's right.
We're a part of it.
That's exactly right. That's what we were saying earlier, that there's a meeting that's beginning to go on. It's still being denied by a lot of scientists, frankly, because they just, you know, they have to protect their reputations and their funding and all the rest of it. But it's obvious to those who are even casually looking that there is a meeting that's beginning to go on.
It is, and it's helping those of us who've been hiding for so long, especially if you have to live in the normal world and take care of your everyday reality, to say, you know, it's okay. We can start talking about these things and being a part of things and not hiding so much, and even having our kids participate.
Well, that, my dear, is why we're on the air. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with William Henry. Hi.
You say West of the Rockies?
I did indeed.
Okay, sorry. Thanks, Art. Yes, quick comment and question. The comment, I don't have any faith in our world leaders to get past where we're at, and they're going to destroy our planet. I think they're like cavemen playing with sophisticated fire. My question is, this war on terror is put forth as a war between the Christians and the Muslims, but I think there's a third group that's not hardly talked about, and that's a Russian-Chinese coalition, and they're using the Islamic radicals to weaken the West, destroy the United States if they can, Israel, so that the Russian and the Chinese coalition can put forth their version of one world government, and I'll listen on the air. Thanks.
Okay, you're very welcome. And what do you think about that, William?
Well,
are the Russians and the Chinese behind some of the
well,
Islamic
it's possible.
Terrorism?
I mean, China does have a 500-year plan for the future, so they definitely operate on a much faster time scale than we do, and they could just be waiting for us to cancel each other out, and they come in and take what's left.
Could be. I'm not one who thinks that is necessarily so, but could be. Wildcard line, you're on the air with William Henry.
Hello.
Hello. Yes, hello.
Hi, great. I'm on the air. My name is Mariah, and I'm calling from Utah. And I am a grandchild of the African slaves. And the one thing I wanted to say is, as far as the war between Muslims and Christians, I remember 500 years ago where we were beat and killed and raped because we did not conform to Christianity. And we will not forget. And that's the one thing I wanted to tell you.
Yeah, that happened. That's right. And the fact, though, that people are not forgetting about things like that is exactly what's driving our future and our present.
And that won't go unpunished either.
Won't go unpunished.
It will not.
Yeah, but, you know, eventually it's going to have to be forgotten in some way or another, or we're just going to destroy ourselves. You don't want to see that happen.
The eradication of the Caucasian race.
The eradication of the Caucasian race. Is that what you want
to
see?
Right. Hey, I love my country. I love my leaders. But there's one thing that I will not forget. That's what has happened to us and my grandmother and my grandfathers. And we are the ancient Egyptians.
Mm-hmm. Well, William, not a lot of light there.
Well, she did bring her voice up for healing, and hopefully the audience can come in and send her light, send her love, and everybody else that was involved with that, and that serves a very important purpose in her making that call.
Oh, it does, and I hope she feels better for it, but the eradication of this race or that race or this religion or that religion, I don't know. It's all pre-light stuff, that's for sure.
Absolutely. And it goes to this idea that if you're focused on hate, you're certainly not in a space of love. And so why can't we take the same energy and emotion and put it into love and reaching for the stars? That's the whole point of this flip from terror to terra to compassion and enlightenment.
All right, buddy. Do you want to plug again the Bay Area UFO Expo? Because it's the soonest.
Absolutely. Thank you, Art. Yeah, that's September 8th through the 10th with John Lear, Nick Bagich, Danian Brinkley, William Henry. It's a phenomenal weekend, an incredible experience, and good chance to meet and greet everybody, and hope everybody will join in.
Okay, well, it sounds like it'll be a big one, that's for sure. How about any books? Do you have any books that you want to mention?
You. Yeah, my new DVD set, Shadow of Atlantis, is the most recent, and also The Illuminator, about Mary Magdalene and her connection to these mysteries.
And those are available
at WilliamHenry.net.
WilliamHenry.net. All right, buddy, it has been a pleasure. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Art, so much.
You have a good night. Take care.
Many blessings.
All right, everybody, tomorrow night is an Ed Dames, Major Ed Dames kind of night, and he's had some recent very interesting predictions come true. And with North Korea doing as it is doing right now, I've got the sad feeling another one of them may be about to come true. From Southeast Asia, the other side of the world, I'm Art Bell. Good night.